Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, into your town, into your home, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, your designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophony of conversation. Glad to be back with you once again. You know, it's been a while since we've had any encouraging or even interesting developments on the UFO front, but suddenly there have been high-profile developments on a couple of fronts with others just around the corner, and tonight we jump into them with both feet to figure out where this topic might be heading. Many of you probably saw the story a couple of weeks ago about new documents from Britain's Ministry of Defense, how Winston Churchill allegedly ordered a UFO cover-up of sorts, wanted to keep a particular encounter incident secret because of fears of widespread panic. At least that's the story. That story made all the network newscasts all over the world, including nearly all of the major American networks, which is a rarity for a UFO story. Then a couple days ago in Brazil, the Brazilian military took its latest and boldest step, ordering new changes in how UFO reports are handled and basically declaring that the public has a right to know what's going on when UFO cases are reported and investigated, saying that from now on, all cases, civilian or military, will be investigated and the public can see the files. It's kind of a refreshing change, similar to what a few other countries around the world have been doing or are doing. On our website tonight, Webmaster Lex and I have a couple of items posted of interest, including one about this Brazilian story. Also, there is a link to a UFO special that aired just once as far as we know. It's from the Disney organization, which, if you know anything about the history of UFO research and the government involvement, you know that Disney has played a part over the years. I think this thing aired in 1995. You can't find it online anywhere, at least not to buy a copy of it, but someone sent us a link. I think it's worth a look. I believe that this program came out around the time that Disney unveiled a new attraction at Disney World in Florida. It was a ride called the Extraterrestrial or something like that. I'm not sure if that thing is still there. In conjunction with the unveiling, Disney invited a couple of UFO researchers down to Florida. Don and Vicki Ecker were there, Yvonne Smith. I even went along for the ride. Not sure if that ET ride is still running, but you can watch the program on the link we've posted. Don't watch it now, of course. Do it at your leisure after our Coast to Coast broadcast. A couple of other items of interest posted on the website. An opinion column about the proposed Ground Zero mosque. Don't get me started on that one. And a weird article about whether Google might want to use drones to spy on our home, sort of an extension of that drive-by video operation they've got where they drive through your neighborhood, videotape every home in America, and you can look it up online or on your phone. This story's from Britain. I'm not sure. Maybe it's a little bit exaggerated, but you can take a look at it. Two other developments in the UFO field worthy of note. One is the release of an important new book by investigative reporter Leslie Kane, who spent the last 10 years interviewing generals, pilots, government officials to find out what they know about UFOs and whether our country needs a new paradigm, a new mechanism for approaching this subject. Her book is out. The reviews are tremendous, and these reviews are coming from people outside the UFO world. They're coming from academics, from military folks. Leslie Kane will be joining me in just a couple of minutes to talk about the book and the future of UFO research, whether there's a whole new ball game coming for this much maligned topic, maybe even an official UFO agency to study, investigate, and report back to the public. And then in hours 3 and 4, Robert Hastings is back to tell us about a big event he has planned for next month in Washington, D.C. It's a news conference at the National Press Club to unveil evidence and testimony about UFO cases involving nuclear weapons installations. Robert has been here before. He's uncovered some amazing testimony, and tonight he'll be here to talk about it and also to introduce us to one of his most important witnesses, a former military man with an astonishing and sobering story to tell us. So put on a pot, kick back, and let's get ready to rumble here with the UFO extravaganza. Maybe during the course of the evening we'll play a song or two for you Elvis fans who are remembering a sad anniversary this week. I'll be right back with journalist Leslie Kane here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Knapp. Leslie Kane is an investigative journalist. Her articles have appeared in all the major newspapers in the country, major magazines as well. About 10 years ago, though, she got hooked on the UFO subject. And ever since, she's been interviewing people, collecting evidence, and has now put it all together in an astonishing new book called UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. The reviews have been great, overflowing, and I read the book and finished it today. And, Leslie, I have to tell you, I have to agree with him. It's a wonderful work.
Well, thanks very much, George, and I'm just so pleased to be on with you tonight.
You know, it's sort of like your philosophy is less is more, because you've whittled it down to the essentials. You go after the most credible people. People who were in a position to know. You cite official government documents, not a whole lot of speculation, cut out a lot of the wild stuff that gives the UFO field a bad name.
Yeah, well, I mean, that was really my intention in the book, because I'm trying, you know, what I really want to do with this book is reach an audience of high-level people in this country, because we want to affect change. We can talk about that more later. But, yeah, as a journalist, I really tried to apply a very rigorous standard to the information, only present the most solid, the most credible material. And I'm also trying to reach a larger mainstream audience, George, you know, rather than the people that usually read UFO books. I want this to be a book for somebody who's never read a UFO book before. And when they read it, I don't think they're going to be able to argue with the data and just say that there's nothing to it. So I'm really trying to create sort of a breakthrough here into a new audience, and I hope it works.
Well, there is a big audience out there for this stuff, and you know, everybody has sort of a casual interest in it, but it sometimes strikes me, and I'm sure you, as you go to the UFO conferences, it's the same people preaching the same message to the same audience over and over, and that gets old.
Absolutely, and it's often not based on facts. I mean, it's repetitious, but I think a lot of the lectures and the conferences and so on are just, you know, sort of, as you said, wild and speculative, you know. So I'm really trying to, you know, what is it that we actually know about the subject? What are the facts, and what is the most credible information? What is real and what isn't? I mean, all those questions need to be sorted out, and that's what I'm trying to do here.
I have heard you describe yourself as an agnostic on the topic of UFOs, and there's a quote from Miles O'Brien on the cover, a cover blurb, in which he says, like me, meaning Miles, Leslie is an agnostic. An agnostic, depending on the definition, I mean, it can be a person unwilling to commit to an opinion, a non-believer, a skeptical, non-committal. I'm not quite sure how you use it, whether you mean agnostic in the terms of having journalistic detachment and maintaining objectivity. And I ask the question in this sense. Obviously, you're not a non-believer in the large sense, or you wouldn't have wasted your last couple of years writing a book about it.
Absolutely. I'm so glad you asked that question, because when you see that quote, you know, it's kind of an isolated quote. It does raise the question, well, what does she mean? What does he mean by agnostic here? It's only in the context of the book that I think I hope that that's clear what I mean. And let me just explain. Obviously, I'm not agnostic about the reality of a physical phenomenon. I mean, the book shows clearly that we have an unknown phenomenon, and all the properties that it demonstrates over and over again are factual. By the word agnostic there, I'm really talking specifically about the determination of what the objects actually are. You know, a lot of people think that the word UFO means alien spacecraft, means extraterrestrial spacecraft just by definition, and it actually doesn't. It means unidentified flying object. And I'm taking the position in this book, along with the people who have contributed to it, which are 18 incredible guys, I'm taking the position that we do not know what these objects are. And so that's where the word agnostic comes in. I don't know. You know, I can go this way, I can go that way. There's certain things that I think are the most logical explanation for them, but I'm not going to take a position on that, because we still don't know, and we need to have a more definitive scientific exploration done that can really determine this definitively once and for all. So that's the only sense that I'm agnostic about it. It's really, you know, whether they're extraterrestrial or not. That's the bottom line question.
I don't think
we know the answer yet.
I don't think anybody who says they know the answer, anybody that does, is full of baloney.
Well, lots of people just do it, and they say, oh, the extraterrestrials are here, and we're being visited, and we got to go around Washington and tell people that, and, you know, and obviously that's not a productive thing to do, because we don't know yet for sure.
There are a couple of personal points that you describe in your narrative that kind of hit me since I remember going through something similar, and one is the point at which you realize, holy moly, this is real. I'm not sure what it is, but I'm pretty darn sure what it isn't. It's some of it anyway. It's not swamp gas. It's not weather balloons. It's not our imaginations. It's real. It really is mysterious. It truly is unexplained. It deserves to be investigated. That is a delicate and profound moment for a journalist, I would think. For you, that moment came when you read a report from France 10 years ago, right?
Right, exactly. I mean, it took a little while. I had to look into the report, and I looked into other stuff, you know, when I started to investigate the subject. But you're right. I mean, I think everybody must get to that point, because at first, we don't know what this is. In fact, most of us are probably pretty skeptical about it. And then you cross some kind of a line, and I try to describe what that's like when I wrote the book, where you just cannot anymore, you know, hold back. You suddenly realize it's sort of like an oh, wow moment. My God, you know. And once you kind of let into your consciousness and your reality the fact that there's this incredible mystery out there and there's a possibility that there are extraterrestrial spacecraft here, it changes your whole perspective. I mean, it changes your sense of what the universe is and who we are and how we fit in. And it's almost, you know, it's a very kind of internal and transformative kind of process. At least it was for me, and I think it is for a lot of people. So I'm sure you went through that too, George, because you spent a lot of time investigating and reporting on this subject as well.
Yeah, it's almost like a born again kind of an experience where we,
I know, I hate to make it religious because
yeah,
I'm not religious, but it does have a very transformative effect. And you can imagine what it's like for the people that actually see one. I mean, that's going to hit them. That's even, I mean, for us, we're talking about an experience based on just learning, you know, information and then studying information. But when you've actually experienced the thing yourself, that's probably something I can't even imagine, but that's going to hit, you know, be even more intense for people.
The other thing you mentioned in the book that struck a personal chord is the question that you get from people that you know or you meet, and they ask you, I'll bet it happens every day. It happens to me every day. Do you really believe in UFOs? And as you note, that question is really, it's really awkward, and it's off base, and it's not really what people want to ask. And like I said, I give it everywhere I go. And what they really want to know is if I believe UFOs are from outer space or alternate reality or something exotic, right?
I know. I mean, that is so important, George. And, you know, I make that point in the beginning of the book. I mean, it is so important. And you're right. That question is, oh, you believe in UFOs? And it's like, you know, when I don't think that this book and I don't think any factual reporting about the phenomenon has anything to do with belief. It's not,
right.
It's got nothing to do with belief. What I'm doing in this book and what a lot of other people have done too, you know, I'm trying to present my own unique way of doing it. But, and we can talk about that too, because I want to talk a bit about all the contributors that have actually written their own first person accounts. But yeah, I mean, we have a certain body of knowledge. We have government documents. We have facts that show us something. And it's not about believing in anything. The belief factor comes in when you want to decide what they are. And that's where, you know, the word agnosticism comes in. If you're agnostic, it means you don't know. Well, that is really the accurate scientific position to take on this phenomenon, is to be agnostic. And anybody that believes that they're this or that, or also be on the other side, George, believes that they can't possibly be here, therefore they don't exist. I mean, both of those positions are untenable and are not really, you know, pointing to what we actually know and don't know. So
well, let's
belief
get into,
is a big problem.
Yeah, that's for sure. Let's get into talking about some of the contributors. The first name that pops out at you as you pick up this book is the guy who wrote the foreword, and that's John Podesta from the Clinton White House, you know. And I'll ask you about him in this context. There were people who had high hopes for the Clinton administration regarding UFOs, that Bill Clinton was known to have an interest in this, and maybe if he can find out, he'd spill the beans, and maybe there are some cracks coming in the cover-up. And, of course, the same was true for Jimmy Carter. I suppose some people probably hoped the same would be true for Obama, and it never seems to happen. Did you have a conversation with John Podesta about his interest in this topic, about Clinton's interest, and whether or not they had determined there's a cover-up or where the information is hidden or what the political reality of dealing with the topic is at that level?
Yeah, I mean, as far as I know, George, you know, it's not as much on their radar screens as one might like to think. I mean, it's not like John Podesta and Bill Clinton spent time sitting around, and this is, of course, as far as I've been told now. They, you know, and it is really my sense of it, is that they didn't sit around wondering about UFOs. I mean, these are incredibly busy guys running the United States of America. And, you know, yes, Bill Clinton made an inquiry to try to get some information, but, you know, John Podesta was not really part of that universe when Bill Clinton, he wasn't part of the process that Bill Clinton was involved in when he tried to get the information. And it's sort of like, I think people read a lot more of importance into that aspect of it than is really warranted. I mean, both men have a curiosity and interest in UFOs, but as far as I'm concerned, that's as far as it goes. And there's not, like, you know, some deep, dark, hidden secrets that they know about or that they know exist and that they want to get and that they spend time talking to people about it. And I just, my sense of it is that a lot of that is sort of wishful thinking and that people have read a lot into the situation, and it just doesn't, you know, these guys are way too busy to spend a lot of time thinking about UFOs.
Yeah, they do have other stuff on their
plates. They have a genuine curiosity about it, no doubt.
Talk to me about your other contributors, generals, government officials,
right.
Pilots. Give me the list.
Yeah, I mean, we've got five generals. We've got from different parts of the world, and one, you know, I mean, we can go into different specific people if you'd like, but the five generals are a really, really important part of the book, and some Air Force pilots and some commercial pilots, and Richard Haynes, who is the head of a NARCAF, and he's a senior research scientist from NASA who's been studying aviation safety cases for decades. And I think that's a really important aspect of the phenomenon, which we kind of weave throughout the book. Two political scientists have written a really interesting piece about the UFO taboo and what some of the issues are that underlie the fears that people have about UFOs. We've got John Callahan, who people are probably familiar with from the press conference in 2007. He was also at Stephen Greer's press conference years ago. So some of these cases are familiar to people, but I think what's really unique about this, well, some of them aren't. I mean, Major General Dennis Leddy was one of the originators of the Cometa report. He's never written anything before that people have read. And even the cases here that might be familiar, such as the Iran 1976 case, this is the first time that these men have ever actually sat down and written in their own words the stories of what happened to them, what they were thinking during these events, what their emotions were, what they did when they landed, right afterwards. These are the people that actually have encountered them. And the investigators, what did they learn? Why were they investigating them? I mean, it's very, very personal. And I think that's what's just so special about these pieces that I'm just so thrilled with.
Yeah, the Iran case is probably top 10 all-time UFO cases. I mean, it was kept secret for a long time, and the only thing that we have read until your book here is reports that were forced out of the government through the Freedom of Information Act and military reports about what went on that night.
Right. It's the famous three-page Department DIA document that a lot of people have read, which is an amazing document because it's the U.S. government spending three pages talking about this UFO incident when they've been telling everybody since the close of Blue Book that they're not interested in UFOs. So, I mean, the document is phenomenal in itself. But when you actually read the story of General Jafari, who was one of the two pilots that went up and actually tried to shoot at these projectiles coming out of this huge UFO, it's just phenomenal, I think, to read his story in his own words. And that's what's really different here. I mean, it's the first time we're hearing directly from these people in great detail.
We talked, I don't know if you heard the introduction, but I was talking about some other developments around the world. Brazil, for example, the announcement that was made a couple of days ago about them opening up their files. We've been reading about the Ministry of Defense in Britain. I'm sure you read about the Churchill story that made news all over. You look at Britain, Brazil, Chile and Peru, which you mentioned in your book, even Russia has spit out some classified files, France, the Cometa report that got you started. What is it about the United States that is different from all those countries? I mean, it's not just agnosticism on the part of our government. They do ignore the topic, at least in public anyway, but it seems like outright hostility, overt debunking, and in some cases, as you mentioned in your book, disinformation.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true, and I think it's a huge question and a topic that we could talk about for hours and all the different components of that. But one of the things I'm highlighting in the book is the point you're making, how extraordinarily different the U.S. is from these other countries and the way it approaches the subject or doesn't approach the subject. And it's withholding of information. It's ignoring a very important event, such as the 2006 O'Hare incident would be a good example of a recent event. And even when it is forced to deal with an event like it was at O'Hare, it'll come out with some inane explanation that is not factual. You know, O'Hare, it was factually proven that the explanation they give can't happen, couldn't have been. I mean, it was just an impossibility. So these kinds of things in these other countries just don't happen that way. I mean, they have agencies that will responsibly investigate an event and then will put out the information to the general public. And they're not afraid to say, you know, these objects could not be identified. And this, we in this country, we're not asking the government to tell us that they're extraterrestrial. I mean, I don't think there's any point in demanding that. It's the question is they need to investigate the events and just tell us what they learn. And if they don't know what the object is, it's okay to say that. So you're right. I mean, I think there's a sort of very irrational hostility could be the word. And the debunking mentality, of course, was set up back in the 1950s with the CIA Robertson panel, which, you know, a lot of people have heard about. And I present that in the book as well. There's a lot of factors affecting it.
Well, we'll get into that. I want to talk about the Japan Airlines case and about O'Hare when we come back in some detail, get into the descriptions that were handed out to explain those cases away. Stay with us. We're talking with Leslie Kane, author of the new book, UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record, here on Coast to Coast AM. Leslie Kane is my guest here to talk about her new book on the UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. Leslie, let's talk for a minute or two about the nature of proof, because when it comes to this subject, I guess no proof is good enough. You know, you got eyewitness sightings, and of course eyewitnesses can be wrong, radar reports, and they can be wrong, of photos, video. Somebody who doesn't want to believe it isn't going to believe it no matter what the nature of the evidence. I'd like to know, what is the most persuasive evidence for you? What turns you around on this?
Well, that's a big question. I mean, I think what you mentioned, George, there are some cases that are just so strong. And as you know, when you take each little piece of evidence apart, sort of like the eyewitness testimonies aren't good over here, or this isn't good over there. But when you have within one case all of those things, you have eyewitness accounts that actually correspond with what's going on radar. You have the pilots talking to ground control back and forth about what's going on. You know, all kinds of effects on airplanes. I mean, it can be such a conglomeration of data and so many people involved. And then U.S. government documents that come out of it. I mean, there's, you know, it's just impossible to look at certain cases and just say, well, this, you know, nothing adds up. I mean, it's the combination of stuff that really, really points to the reality of some kind of phenomenon. There's just no way around it. And the accumulation of cases that we have. And documents. I mean, it's
well. You've kind of become a specialist in squeezing documents out of the government, right? FOIA, FOIA documents and things of that sort. You've been.
Well, yeah, I mean, I worked on this one case in particular, the Kexburg case. But a lot of the documents that I reference in the book, I certainly want to give credit to the other people who worked so hard to get those documents from the government. A lot of them were released in the 70s and 80s when there was a lot of work being done. So, I mean, I'm really picking the ones that are the most significant. And, you know, I didn't do a lot of documents because it can get kind of boring. But in relation to the cases that I actually covered in the book and the cases in which the people wrote their own stories about them, those documents are very, very significant. But I'm not responsible for getting those released. I want to make that clear and give credit where credit's due.
Understood. I would just say that was always the documents are what were most persuasive to me in starting out the research, because a lot of these things were written long before the Freedom of Information Act was law, and they were written specifically for, you know, classified eyes only. They were never meant to be distributed. And it's in those kinds of reports that you get really candid explanations and evaluations of the UFO reality.
Exactly. I mean, for instance, the Twining memo, the really famous Twining memo, is kind of one of the best examples. And, you know, why? I mean, these government officials in high levels, you know, writing memos back and forth to each other are not sitting there making things up. You know, it's just not, that's just not the way it works. So, you know, I agree with you. The early documents especially are really, really revealing and really interesting, and they never intended for anybody else to read them. So you can learn a lot from those.
Let's talk about a couple of cases. Belgium. Now, you have an interview. You have material from General de Brouwer from Belgium. Talk about what he saw and what he revealed to you.
Okay, and actually, just to clarify, I mean, he's actually written his own piece for the book. So,
sure.
Yes, I've interviewed him a lot, and I sort of introduce him in the book, but I think what's really extraordinary is that he's written this in his own words, and he's a major general. And he starts off his piece by just describing lots of, you know, examples of the hundreds and hundreds of sightings that took place in his country that were documented. And he's got drawings that he provides that witnesses have done, and just, you know, this, it was just an amazing, amazing event where these large triangular objects kept returning over this tiny country for a period of a year and a half, 2 years. And he was a colonel at the time, and he was in charge of this investigation that the Air Force took on to try to figure out what the hell these things were, you know, that were coming in. And he really worked at it, and they even launched F-16s a couple of times to try and get closer and chase them. And he writes about what it was like for him to be investigating these events. And the bottom line being that he was never, and other branches of the government as well who worked with him, were never able to explain what they were. And he also approached, you know, governments around the world, including the United States, to try and find out if these could be some kind of stealth aircraft that we were testing or something that, you know, was secret. And it absolutely was not. And he's thoroughly convinced that that's the case, and that's what he was told at the time. So it's pretty fascinating. I think it's one of the strongest cases we have on record, actually.
Yeah, you've got eyewitnesses, thousands of them. You have several different incidents. You have radar reports. You have some photographs, drawings from the witnesses, the testimony of military officials, and then you have the documents that you or someone else you refer to in the book that indicates from our government that it's not ours.
Exactly. I mean, that's an incredible combination of things. I agree with you. And, you know, numerous agencies in Belgium were involved, I mean, at the highest levels. It wasn't just the Air Force. And you had a scientific group, too. I mean, this is one of the things that's so extraordinary, you know, that is so inconceivable that we could ever imagine happening in this country. There was a group of very qualified scientists that were really the ones responsible for collecting a lot of the interviews, the witness testimonies, and filing them. And they've got volumes and volumes and volumes of these hard copy reports. And, you know, it would have been very hard for the Air Force to be responsible for collecting all of those reports. It was very time consuming. So they cooperated with a group of scientists. I mean, it makes total sense, right? A rational way to go about it. These scientists were interested and they volunteered to do this. They were highly qualified and they had a cooperative relationship. And, you know, it's just hard to imagine something like that ever happening here.
The Japan Airlines case, and you mentioned this briefly in talking about Mr. Callahan, you know, that was a really interesting case. I remember when it happened and it made news all over the world, and then sort of the FAA started dribbling out various explanations, and then the debunkers got involved, and it was lights bouncing off the shrimp fleet and all kinds of crazy explanations that were, it was just like, toss out anything and see what sticks to the wall and make this thing go away. But the FAA go ahead.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, the final conclusion of the FAA was that there was something wrong with the radar. It was just bogus targets, you know, even though the targets were corresponded perfectly with the visual sightings of, I mean, Callahan has all that evidence. And even though there was a perfect correlation and there were three pilots, and the FAA stated that these were very sane, sound individuals, they were not drinking or anything like that. You know, and nonetheless, they just made this conclusion that the radar was faulty. So, I mean, you know,
like, go ahead. In a case like that, do you believe that the FAA is just being sloppy and lazy, or is that it's more sinister than that?
You know, I wish I knew, George. I mean, you know, that's a really good question. I mean, you know, Callahan, of course, is very sort of cynical about the whole thing, and I think he's angry about it. I don't even know if he really knows exactly what's behind the attitudes that they have. I mean, a lot of it may be that they just don't know how to cope with UFOs, you know, because they can't explain them. They don't have any way of monitoring them. They don't have any equipment for properly even documenting them, really, because lots of times the radar isn't equipped to handle the speeds that they go at and the hovering. It's just something that it just seems like they do not want to deal with it. And they don't want people to get all worked up about it.
Well, I mean, there are practical reasons why that should be untenable. And the 2006 O'Hare case is an example of that. This is right over one of the busiest airports in the world. Describe basically the events that happened and then describe the FAA response, because they didn't want to admit that there was anything to it, right?
Right. And, I mean, this is such an important case because it happened only a few years ago. And, yeah, and people may remember it was a breaking story in the Chicago Tribune at the time that there was a very metallic-looking anyway. I mean, it was described by many people as a round disc object, metallic-looking, that was hovering right over the United Airlines terminal about 1,500 feet up, which isn't very high, and there was a cloud bank right above it. So it was suspended below the cloud bank where the sky was still clear. And it sat there for at least 5 minutes, and you had pilots looking at it. You had, you know, pilots leaning out of their windows on the ground, sitting in their planes, and they were looking up at it, and they were actually radioing to other people. There was a lot of radio communication about it. Calls were coming into the FAA tower about it. I mean, it was a big buzz at the airport. This thing was there. And after some time, estimates range 5 to 10 minutes, the disc suddenly shot straight up, just from a hovering position, just in the blink of an eye, shot straight up and went through the cloud bank. And what's amazing is it cut a cookie cutter, clean hole with a very distinct edge right through the clouds when it went up. And you could see blue. Those that were right underneath it could see actually the sky through the hole. And, you know, I don't think we have, I mean, and no one I've talked to has said that we have any technology that can do that. So, I mean, it was quite phenomenal. And, again, all these aviation people saw it. So the FAA's explanation was that it was weather. I mean, you've just got to laugh at that. And it is
some kind of weird donut hole weather or something like that. What was it called?
Exactly. I mean, at first they just said weather. Well, I actually called up the guy who said weather, and I tried to get him to explain, well, what kind of weather can do that? You know, first of all, it was 4:30 in the afternoon. It was still daylight. There was nothing unusual going on with the weather. All the weather was recorded by all the normal equipment that they have at airports. And the National Weather Service documents all weather. So, I mean, you know, and so I asked him, and the guy said, and I wrote about this in the book, this conversation where he says that it was a hole punch cloud. It's a natural phenomenon. I assume that's what he was talking about, but I wanted to hear him say it. And he, you know, this is a phenomenon that happens very rarely. And as I explain in the book, it's a natural phenomenon that requires certain conditions to occur, certain temperatures and certain processes that go on in the clouds. And those conditions were not in existence that day. This is the most important one being that it had to be below freezing for a hole punch cloud to exist, which it was not. So,
as I recall it from the book, is that the FAA was saying that there's no tapes, there's no exchanges between anyone who claims to have seen it in the tower, and then you have a transcript of this thing.
Right. I mean, at first they didn't want to release any information. That's absolutely right. And they were eventually forced to release information through the Freedom of Information Act. And thank God for the Freedom of Information Act. I'm sure there's a lot we don't get. But, yeah, that conversation is so revealing because this you know, woman who's calling up, who's one of the employees, I forget exactly what her, you know, station was there, but she was reporting to the tower that all these people had seen this disc, and she was just being laughed at. And these were professionals, you know, who were supposed to be concerned about aviation safety. And she had to defend herself and say, look, I haven't been drinking. And, you know, that shows the sort of mentality that surrounds. And even during the time that the object was actually there hovering over a major airport, you know, these people were so prejudiced against it that they made fun of her and sort of laughed about it. So that shows the need for people to become trained and informed about this phenomenon. That's one aspect of this.
Yeah, because it carries some fairly significant public safety issues here and concerns.
Certainly. I mean, and then the witnesses who did come forward, and, you know, a lot of them didn't, and the ones that did, it's also interesting that not one was willing to put their name on the record. But those that did file reports, and they initially filed their reports with Newfork, did so because they were concerned about the aviation safety factors. I mean, you know, you got some strange thing hovering over an airport. You know, if that had been some kind of unidentified helicopter or something like that, don't you think the airport people would have gone berserk? I mean, you know, it's just that there is this incredible prejudice against dealing and confronting the reality of an unknown phenomenon there. And it's just so striking in that case. It's so clearly illustrated.
I want to talk more about pilots, sightings, and airline safety and things of that sort in a couple of minutes. But before we leave O'Hare, I remember reading that the journalist who wrote the story for the Chicago paper was amazed at the response he got, that the paper had something like 1 million visits to its website in a couple of days, and it was astonished and pleased with all the attention, and then it just drops the story. That's the part that I have a hard time understanding, why there aren't more people like you, mainstream journalists, who would be interested in a subject like this that obviously touches the pulse of the public and carries enormous implications if it can be proven.
I know. I mean, like you too, George. I know you've been on this for a long time. But, yeah, I've spoken to John. I mean, John Hilkovich, who wrote the piece for the Chicago Tribune, was actually the transportation reporter. So, he usually carries these sort of mundane stories about things going on in the transportation world in Chicago. And, yeah, this absolutely blew him out of the water. You're right. They got like 1 million hits from all over the world. He was, you know, just barraged by emails from all over the world, and he went on all these TV talk shows. And, yeah, I dropped the story. Now, it might be hard for him to know what else to do. I mean, this was a one-time event, and he did cover it. But what he could have done is when NARCAP, the Richard Haynes' group, National Aviation Reporting Center for Anomalous Phenomena, which is a really wonderful scientific group that studies aviation safety cases. They did an in-depth report on this event. It took months, and it was like a long, detailed scientific study of the event. John Hilkovich was sent that report, and he could have done another story at that time, but he didn't. So it is mysterious. You're right. He could have had a whole other round of attention at that point, and for some reason he didn't do it. I don't know why.
You mentioned Richard Haynes, who's been at this a long time. I forget the number, but it's something over 3,000 cases that he's investigated. He's not a UFO crazy. He worked for NASA. He starts hearing these stories over and over again from pilots involved in flight simulation demos and equipment, and he starts compiling them together. And he is convinced that what is happening in our skies is a legitimate threat to airline safety, passenger safety, that needs to be addressed.
Absolutely, and that is the focus. That's been the focus of his research for over 30 years, and he does very interestingly describe in the book, you know, how it first came to his attention. He was certainly a total skeptic in the beginning, and then just started looking into it. And you know, his focus is documenting the cases that affect aviation safety, and there are enough of them that, you know, there's no reason why this shouldn't be considered. He makes the point, just along with things like wind shear and bird strikes and things that don't happen very often, but nonetheless happen enough that pilots are at least educated about them. You know, why shouldn't this be thrown into the mix and they could also be educated about this? So his focus is really to bring this to the aviation community, and it's been really a struggle, but they've done a tremendous job of research and documentation, and I support that group.
I think
they're a great group.
Yeah. How serious do you think the threat is to pilot careers, pilots who offer to report these incidents, UFO sightings, things of that sort, near misses? Do they really get fired? Do they really get threatened?
Well, I mean, it seems, according to what Dick Haynes says, Dr. Haynes, who has been, again, he's the one that's done the most interviews with these pilots, certainly there's a very significant threat. And that's why a lot of them don't report it. I mean, there's two factors. One is the ridicule factor, and the second one is the job security factor. And people, even as recent as O'Hare Airport, the reason we didn't get more reports was for that very reason, that they're concerned about their careers. And I've talked to some of these pilots myself. I've talked to quite a few who have that concern in a very big way. And I think they're sort of given subtle messages. It's not direct, but they can tell that this is not a good idea. And the ones that do report it often have repercussions. In fact, you brought up the Alaska Airlines case. Captain Taracci, who was the lead pilot in that case, who spoke out and filed reports and did extensive interviews with the FAA, was actually laid off from his job after this incident. And Richard Haynes went to Japan in order to talk to Japan Airlines on his behalf, and he was reinstated. But it's a real problem for these pilots.
What I'm surprised about, and you mentioned it briefly in your book in passing, is the lack of reports or almost a total lack of information coming out of air traffic controllers. And I've filed FOIAs locally and nationally trying to get info out of air traffic controllers. You would think that would be a goldmine of information, but if they're writing anything down, they sure aren't releasing much of it.
Yeah, and I don't know how much they write things down. I mean, I know they're supposed to keep the tapes. I mean, so much of, I guess, the air traffic controllers. Of course, there's the dialogues they have with the pilots, and then there's the radar traces that they have on their machines. And I know that they're supposed to be kept for a certain amount of time, but then I think there's a time period, maybe, I don't know, 20 days, or I'm not exactly sure, George, but then I think a lot of it just gets destroyed. They just can't keep it all. So you have to go really fast, and you won't necessarily get it even if you do that. It's really, really a hard thing for people to get this information.
My guest is Leslie Kane, author of the excellent new book called UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. When we come back, we'll talk about a new paradigm, whether America needs a UFO agency and what that might be able to accomplish. Rush, taking us into the break. Stay with us. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast. Leslie Kane, it's an interesting question. Why aren't there more good quality photos of UFOs if the sightings are still happening and if so many more people have cell phone cameras and video cameras than they used to? And in particular, why is there no picture of that O'Hare Airport incident?
Well, that's a really good question, George, and I want to answer that, but I wonder if I could give out a website address first,
sure.
just because
sure.
we're sort of at a halfway point here. If people want to learn more about the book, and there's some pretty interesting information put up there on my website that talks about some of the contributors and some of their chapters, the address is UFOsOnTheRecord.com. It's sort of an abbreviation of the title of the book, UFOsOnTheRecord.com, and it's also there's a button there if anybody wants to order the book. It's on a discount at Amazon.com, so that makes it easier for people. I just wanted to put that out there.
Sure, and I looked at the website today. It's excellent. You got a lot of other stuff there, including the topic of this question. You got a lot of photos from all over
the world. A lot of photos, and we've got a blog, which we give constant media updates. We've got some video clips of some of the contributors, so I think people will find it interesting. And thank you very much for listening to that. And in terms of the question about the O'Hare case, I mean, it's really interesting because we have the transcript from the tape where this woman, Sue, called into the tower, and she actually says that there was a photograph taken. So she seems to have direct knowledge of a photograph. Now, it's a mystery. We don't know whatever happened to that photograph. And I think that what people have to realize is that when, first of all, probably if any photographs were taken by these pilots and these people on the ground that were, you know, hauling up, you know, loading suitcases into planes and were directing traffic and all the things that they're doing, if they were to have taken a picture, it probably would have been with a cell phone. And when you take a cell phone picture of a disc 1,500 feet up in the sky, you're probably not going to get a very good picture, first of all. People, you know, looking at these things don't carry cameras around, the really good kinds of cameras that we need to get a very good picture. I've also learned, George, from talking to so many witnesses over the years that witness something like this, when they are looking at it, something as extraordinary as a disc hovering or any kind of UFO, they become sort of spellbound by it. They don't want to take their eyes off this object. I mean, you're witnessing something so extraordinary, you never know when it's going to disappear. And people just stare at it, and they're amazed, and they often don't think about taking a picture. And I really understand that from having talked to a lot of people. So you don't get as many pictures as you might think. You know, it's just they don't have the camera handy. They don't want to take their eyes off the thing to look for their camera. You know, it might be in the next room. It might be in their pocket. They got to pull it out. They got to turn it on. They want to just keep staring at this thing. What the hell is this? Is it going to disappear in 30 seconds? So it's not as common a thing as you might think, and I really understand that, and I'm hoping someday that picture will surface that was taken. Whether it would be any good and really reveal anything, we don't know. But it is understandable to me that we don't have more pictures.
I can remember having conversations with Jacques Vallée, and he's not necessarily endorsing the idea that there's some secret MJ-12 type organization with giant rooms full of UFO evidence, but he says if somebody has the evidence, it's the military. I mean, they've got planes up there and satellite surveillance equipment and all kinds of monitors and gun camera photos. We've heard the stories many times over the years of pilots who record things and then they get back down on the ground and somebody comes and grabs it. How much credibility did he give to the idea that there is film, there is video, there are photos, but just not available to the public?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there are more than we've been given access to. And, yeah, you're right. I mean, things get confiscated. They don't get returned. But I think there are enough great pictures, and I have some of them in the book, to really, you know, show that there have been some extraordinary pictures taken. And we talk about gun camera footage. I mean, the Costa Rica photograph that a lot of people may be familiar with, but I've got an absolutely gorgeous copy of that photograph in the book, was it was a government airplane in Costa Rica that had a camera underneath the fuselage, outside the camera, actually, and it was just flying over the terrain, shooting a picture every 17 seconds, just automatically. There were no humans involved. I mean, it was just an automatic camera clicking away, and when they got the footage back, there was this gorgeous picture of this disc. So, you know, that's an example of the kind of picture that can be taken from an airplane. And one of the things I talk about in the book in terms of the aviation safety issue, too, and just the fact that pilots have this incredible opportunity to witness these things at close range more than anybody else because they're up there. If pilots, you know, were informed about this issue, they might just choose to carry cameras. I mean, ideally, they could be provided with cameras. for the purpose of taking pictures of strange things. And we could have a wealth of information that would, you know, that we could all, that the scientific community could then study. So I would love to see more cameras provided to pilots, and but, you know, until they're informed about what's going on and the fact that, there is value in looking at these things and taking pictures, it's not going to happen. So we need a whole change in policy to facilitate more photographs being taken.
One impediment to that are the skeptics, and I use the term skeptic lately, because I think the word has been hijacked. Skeptic used to mean, like, I'm from Missouri, show me. You know, I'm open-minded. You have to show me the proof. And now it means debunker. It means people who would not believe no matter what evidence you showed them. For example, about pilots. You would think that pilots would be good witnesses about what they see in the sky. The hardcore skeptics, like the late Phil Klass, would say, oh, no, pilots are not any better than anybody else. They're eyewitnesses. They can make mistakes just the same. And I guess you've had to run into people like that, Michael Shermer, Seth Shostak, people who, for whom it seems like they go out of their way to explain away these cases in ways that are not always entirely honest.
I know, and I think that one of them, I don't know which one it was, George, but actually made the statement that pilots are actually bad observers. I don't know if it was James Oberg or who it was. The pilots are, like, really notoriously not good observers of things. So, I mean, you know, it's entirely irrational. I mean, anybody in their right mind would realize that when you have a trained person who's trained to identify all things in the sky, I mean, they have to be able to do that because they're up there and they've got hundreds of passengers in their plane that they're responsible for. They have to be able to recognize everything out there, and they're trained to do that. So when something really unusual happens, they can tell that this is not an aircraft better than anybody, and they're also closer to it. So I think that, you know, we have an opportunity. I mean, I write in my book about a plane with pilots and crew being kind of like a natural laboratory for the study of this. I mean, all they have to do is be given cameras and be told that this is not something that doesn't exist. They're not going to be ridiculed if they report it. And, you know, just a simple change like that, and to have reporting forms issued to them, and we could have a wealth of information from pilots. And I can't think of anybody better to document it.
You mentioned the Robertson Report, the 1953 report from the CIA, which they first discussed a national policy of debunking, stripping UFOs of their aura of mystery. A lot of folks believe that that policy is basically what we've got now, whether it was implemented or not. Folks like J. Allen Hynek, who became a hero to UFO investigators, but in his day was a debunker. He was a debunker as much as, say, Phil Klass was. He came up with the explanation that swamp gas was the reason that people were seeing UFOs in Michigan. How do you categorize folks like that? Folks who seem to be professional debunkers who go around and get themselves interviewed on Larry King are always available and always go to extreme lengths to explain these things away, even when the facts don't fit.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how to categorize it, except I think debunker is the perfect word, and irrational debunker at that. I mean, they seem to have a committed position that defies any kind of rational logic. They are committed to debunking this phenomenon no matter what the evidence is, and why they have that commitment is a mystery. I mean, I think everybody's probably different. They have their own agendas, but that's their agenda. And, you know, quite honestly, I just think that we really shouldn't pay a lot of attention to them. I mean, the ones I've seen on Larry King, I mean, Seth Shostak is certainly a very intelligent person, and I respect the work that he's done. But, you know, I mean, there's just a sort of a commitment to that position rather than an openness to exploring what the facts are. And I think if they were willing to be a little more exploratory, it would be a very interesting conversation that we could have with them. I'm hoping this book will serve to open them up. I mean, I don't see how they can read it and maintain that kind of rigidity anymore. And I really want Seth Shostak to read this book and some of the other people. So maybe the dialogue will change. I mean, that's what I'm really hoping for.
Well, I hope so. You've got some of the quotes about the book and reviews about the book from people like Michio Kaku and academics. You would hope that the academic field would be where some progress could be made. I mean, why professors and PhDs would not be interested in pursuing this? I mean, you do have some who are are brave enough and have enough of intestinal fortitude to go after it, Jacques Vallée and Hal Puthoff and folks like that, on a low-key basis. But why it's not more of that, I don't understand.
Yeah, and I do think, you know, part of the problem may be that, you know, there has never been a sort of consolidated volume that, you know, presents the absolute essential material with a sort of analytic overview that sort of pulls it all together. I mean, there's a lot of great books that have been written by researchers that are very detailed, long, almost cyclopedic, you know, volumes that most people, unless they're really interested in the subject, are not going to read. So I think this book sort of forces the information on them, and it makes it very accessible. I mean, it's something that they can, you know, that all they have to read, really, to kind of get the power of this phenomenon. And so maybe it's going to make it easier for them to kind of grasp what it is that people are talking about who are just simply asking that the evidence be examined. I mean, all we're calling for in this book is a scientific investigation. And we do believe that the U.S. government needs to play a role if that's going to happen, if anything's really going to change, and we do outline a strategy for that.
Well, let's talk about that.
No, we're not asking for anything more. It's not that radical.
Let's talk about that for instance for a couple of minutes. A UFO agency, either an American agency or something within the United Nations, talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, what we're proposing here is, you know, and again, this is a jumping off point, is the setting up of a small office somewhere within the U.S. government. It's a small agency, or an office might be a better term, because agency sounds like it's something really big, that would not cost much, because you're talking about one or two staff people in a room where their job is to investigate incidences that come up, basically. They're prepared. They have what they would need to do is sort of like what GEPAN has done in France. And I went over there and I've talked to the people that run GEPAN, have a lot of communication with them. They have a very efficient system. And again, we have a much bigger country than they do, so it's going to take a lot more work. But the idea is that you have a focal point within the government that sets up a network of scientists, weather people, specialists, psychologists, all the people that you need throughout the country that can be called upon at a moment's notice. And different states would have different people, so that if an event occurred, such as, let's say, the Phoenix Lights, which was in 1997, or the O'Hare incident in 2006, we have a staffer there that would immediately get on to investigating that. That person could fly out within a few hours of the event, be there, and have a network in place so that that person could call on these experts from various disciplines to weigh in on it, to come in on the investigation with them. And the reason we need it to be official is because only government officials have access to all the information that's needed to do a proper investigation. I mean, a civilian group has to go through the FOIA and wait 3 months, and maybe they'll get it and maybe they won't. A government official can go in, get access to every single bit of data, all the FAA tapes, interview all the pilots, all the witnesses, get access to any recordings that were made that pilots may have made, other pilots in the sky that might have seen the disc. I mean, we don't even know about in terms of O'Hare whether there were pilots in the sky that saw this thing. So, you know, it gives them a certain power to really do a good investigation. And report on it. Part of the mandate would be that they would then report on it to the public. And if they can't figure out what the thing is, they would say so. And this is what happens in other countries. So we really think that it's time that the U.S. government, you know, takes on the same role as other countries. And it really isn't that big a deal for them to set up this small agency. And I've talked to enough people within, you know, connections to government that have some knowledge of how these things work, that I'm convinced that we have a very good chance of setting up this agency through various mechanisms without it being that big a deal.
Well, but I don't know. I mean, the political realities are, you know, anti-government spending, and then you face the reality of if it takes congressional action to set it up, what congressman puts his name on that bill? And I mentioned that, Leslie, for this reason, is because I think you may even know this. In the mid-1990s, Bob Bigelow here in Las Vegas had two congresspeople who were willing to take this on and talk about having hearings to discuss exactly the kinds of cases you're talking about, those involving flight safety, pilot cases, and those involving national security. And eventually there was hubbub. The word gets out. The UFO community starts making noise, and they shied away from it.
I know. I mean, that's really a problem. I mean, and I think that actually for this, the plan that we're talking about would not require congressional hearings. It would actually just require, for instance, a budget that was being set up for the Department of Defense that was, you know, that a committee might be in charge of. I mean, I've talked to people that explain to me how all this stuff works. And you can write in certain little things. I mean, this is not a big deal. And in terms of the money, it could even be done really without spending any money. I mean, if you didn't set up a specific agency, perhaps you could have officials that are already in the Air Force, say, that would take this on. But ideally, you would have an office with, let's say, even one staff person. That doesn't cost anything in comparison to the money that the Department of Defense spends. So I don't think really you can argue too strongly about not spending money. I mean, the people that wanted to stop it would argue that, but it really wouldn't be very expensive. It wouldn't require hearings. It's just something that could be added onto a broader proposal that might be going into the DOD, and it would be a budgetary proposal. And, you know, they would, if some, it would take one person in one committee to just decide that they're going to go for this, and that the DOD really can't argue with it if their budget depends on it. So, I mean, you know, it's complicated, but I've talked to people that I think have an idea of how it might be able to happen. It needs to be done quietly. I mean, I agree. We don't want the UFO people to be ranting and raving and carrying on about it. It needs to be done behind the scenes. And I don't think that the people involved in the government who might make this happen would even realize the implications of what they were doing. Because once the U.S. government does this and acknowledges, therefore they're acknowledging that there is a phenomenon worthy of investigation, that's a major acknowledgement, because that hasn't been done since Project Blue Book. But they may not even be aware of the implications of what they're doing. So we're hoping we can just sort of slip this in. I know it may sound far-fetched to people, but you know, I think you should read. I would encourage people to read the bit in the book about that, because maybe they'll understand the logic of it. And we'll just do our best to make that happen. And if we have to, you know, alter the plan a little bit, we're certainly open to doing that. And we've got good people to give us advice. And I'll see what happens. We'll do our best.
I think one of the issues for you would be national security cases, because, you know, as the official position of our government, it is there is no UFO connection to national security, no concern about national security. And, of course, there are many cases that belie that position. Some of them, Robert Hastings is going to be here at the top of the hour to talk about UFOs over nuclear missile bases, cases that are fairly well documented. I think you'd have to have somebody at your agency, your UFO agency, with clearance enough to look into those kind of cases as well.
Absolutely, and I certainly commend Robert Hastings for the documentation that he's done. I mean, there are so many fascinating cases that he's written about in his book, and that he will be coming forward with in Washington with some of the witnesses. So that's an important component, because that's something that government officials can relate to, and the aviation safety component is another one. So, I mean, those both of those concerns make the information kind of more accessible to officials, because that's something that they can sort of relate to in a way. It's not just, you know, something. There's it makes it gives them a reason that they can care and still save face, if you know what I mean.
I do. Leslie Kane, we continue our conversation after this break, and we'll be opening up the phone lines with your questions. She's the author of the new book, UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. Leslie Kane, one other point I want to get into before we open the phone lines. In the book, toward the back of the book, you mention about reliable sources who have told you about conversations with high-level military contacts who say they're aware of a deeply hidden program for UFO research, one which is, quote, so closely guarded that even people at the highest levels of the military are denied access to it. I know you're reluctant to get into too much of the cover-up stuff, but you uncovered this witness that I had never read about before, this guy named Miller, who told you some fairly astonishing things. Can you recap that for us?
Yeah, I mean, Will Miller is a retired Navy commander who's had a lot of background in the intelligence world, and people can read more about his bio in the book. But he's a real, genuine insider, as far as I'm concerned. I've known him for a very long time, spent a lot of time talking with him, have spent time with him in person. And you know, he has contacts that have told him of such a program. And, you know, again, as a journalist, you know, I'm always looking for documentation, corroboration, all the things that you need to really put out information. But I trust Will Miller. And all I can tell you is what he has said. And, in fact, in the book, I have some actual he's written emails to me, which I asked him to do for the book, explaining his position on this, telling us what he knows and doesn't know and how he thinks the thing works. And it's very interesting because, again, we're hearing directly from him. It's hard for me to draw conclusions on it except to just put the information out there. And I think, you know, people need to read that and really draw their own conclusions. Again, they can go to my website, UFOsOnTheRecord.com, and, you know, I hopefully people will want to get the book. But, yeah, but Will Miller is somebody that people have brought up quite a bit because he is kind of a new voice to people here. And
but in a nutshell, he's saying that there is some sort of a program somewhere, and it's so deep down there that that few people know anything about it.
True. And, you know, and he has sources, and I've heard this from other sources as well. I mean, he's one of the few that's willing to put his name out there and come forward about it. I mean, he's speaking about contacts that he has. He's not one of the people himself that, you know, is directly involved, but he's so trustworthy and so well connected at high levels in the intelligence world that when he tells me his contacts tell him certain things, it means a lot. And I have other sources who have told me completely independently of Miller of a very similar scenario. When you have different sources coming forward at different times from different parts of the structure that don't know each other and telling you the same thing, it's pretty significant. But again, in my chapter about this, you know, I'm not willing to really take a position one way or the other. I also explore the arguments for why it seems unlikely that there might be a program. And, you know, I also think, George, that even if there is, it's such a small elite group of people that are involved that we still need to get our government office in place. We still need to have a public investigation and kind of operate on a parallel track. If those people want to just do their thing in secrecy, let them do it, but it really doesn't affect the rest of us. So we need to behave as if we don't have that program and call for an investigation that all of us can be involved with, which will hopefully get to the bottom of this in a way that can be made public.
Okay, going to the phones. First-time caller Harry in Rancho Cucamonga. How you doing, Harry?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, I have a story regarding the airlines and UFOs. I've made probably 9 or 10 trips to the Philippines, and the typical route of flight for me is out of LAX and then direct to Manila, and from Manila to the destination island, which is Cebu. And on this one particular occasion, during the connecting flight from Manila to Cebu, the aircraft they were using was a 747, which is unusual because of the size of the aircraft and the capacity, and it being just a 50-minute flight from Manila to Cebu. And also what was unusual about it is that I was only one of 30 people on the aircraft, and the reason why they were using a 747 is they were going to refuel it in Cebu and then from Cebu back to Los Angeles for the large passenger flight, you know, back to the Philippines. So anyway, we departed Manila, and of course, not having anybody in the aircraft, I could choose whichever seat that I wanted, and the seat that I chose was the emergency exit seat, having more room. And so anyway, there was a flight attendant, and he was a male flight attendant, and he was a flight steward. I guess he was more than
just... Harry, we need you to get to the point of this one.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Oh, yes, sir. Okay. Well, anyway, I was talking to the flight steward, and I asked him, how long have you been doing this? And he said, I've been a steward for 11 years. And we had a little bit of small talk, and I said, well, can I ask you a question? I said, during these flights, I said, do you, the crew, do you ever see anything? And he says, what do you mean? And I said, well, out there. And he says, you mean UFOs? And I said, yes. And he kind of looked from side to side and leaned over toward me, and he said, we see them all the time. The pilots see them all the time, but they're not allowed to talk about it because if they do, they'll lose their medical. And their medical is the essence of their pilot's license. I'm a pilot myself, so if you lose your medical, you lose your license. And he said, if it doesn't affect the flight, he said they don't discuss it. If it doesn't cause the flight to deviate, but he said they see them all the time, and it's just, you know, part of the business of flying.
Really interesting. I mean, that's a very interesting account, and I think Richard Haynes would be able to verify what you're saying, that it is much more common than we believe, and they do see them, and we don't know about it because they don't file any reports. So I think that's a real example of how of the reality of the situation, and we need to have reporting forms so that these people can file the reports and maybe the scientists can get access to the information. It's just really a shame that we don't have that.
Harry, thanks for that call. You might even want to send a little email to Leslie, and she can put you in contact with Richard Haynes. Maybe there's some worthwhile information in the account you just gave us. Thanks. West
of
the Rockies.
Great. And there is an email, by the way. They can contact me by going to the website again. There is a contact thing there. So UFOsOnTheRecord.com if you want to contact me.
All right. West of the Rockies, Bob in Washington. Hi, Bob.
There actually is a photograph of the O'Hare incident that was looked at by David Biedney and Jeff Richman that worked with Ted Rowe that was authenticated as a legitimate photograph of the O'Hare incident. And so the person that called in earlier and said that, why is there no photograph? Well, I assume they've never read the report. I suggest they actually read the report and do their homework.
I remember seeing a photo of a hole in the cloud. I don't remember seeing a craft, though. Are you talking about a craft, Bob?
David Biedney and photo experts worked with Ted Rowe, and if you go on the internet, if you ask Ted Rowe, you'll find it. There is a photograph. So whoever thinks there's not a photograph, tell them, well, first you should read the report and then come back to us with your explanation.
Yeah, I mean, I have read every word of the NRCAP report when Ted Rowe is the executive director of the NRCAP organization, and there was no report of a photograph. I also know David Biedney very well, and I can't believe he wouldn't have told me if there was one. They may have analyzed one and weren't able to determine that it was authentic. So, any case, I appreciate your letting me know that, and I will get back to those people and check and make sure that I'm correct that there isn't one.
Thanks, Bob.
But I don't think there is.
All right. Thanks for the call. East of the Rockies, Loran in Atlanta. Good morning.
Hi. How you guys doing? Leslie, earlier you were talking about setting up an agency within the United States that would investigate UFO sightings. You also mentioned that other countries have had and are currently implementing such agencies to do that. To your knowledge, what have those agencies in the other countries concluded during their investigations?
Well, and that's, again, something that they themselves have written about in the book, and I think you'll find it really interesting to read what they say. In a nutshell, they have accumulated lots of data. Every case is different. Every country is different. The people reporting on them have different personalities, which also come through in the pieces. But, you know, basically, they have documented very, very strong cases, and they're all mystified by it. And, they would all agree that the extraterrestrial hypothesis is certainly valid. It needs to be explored, and we need to have more of an investigation. I mean, it was really interesting to me, actually, going around the world. These people are all working independently, and they basically come to the same conclusions. I mean, they have their own way of expressing it and dealing with it. But the fact that they all come to the same kind of conclusion is sort of a verification of the consistency of the phenomenon and makes the point that if it's properly investigated, everybody's going to kind of realize the same thing. And that's what happens. But I think each person's experience is unique, and that's what's really interesting to read about.
What if, Leslie, that, we have an investigation, separate independent investigations, they collect thousands and thousands of more cases. 50 years from now, we know that it's still an important topic, everybody recognizes it, but the ultimate truth itself of who they are and what they want, where they're from, is unknowable.
Really, I mean, that's so important, George, because, and I make that point again in the book, that really the answer to this problem is not to collect more case data. I mean, we don't need any more release of documents. at least not the highly sensitive, you know, national security documents that we're not going to get anyway. We don't need any more documents. We don't need any case investigations. That's not to say that we don't want them, and, you know, that they certainly are interesting. But I think that setting up an agency that has the task of investigating cases that come along, and again, we're only talking about very significant cases such as O'Hare, is just a way to get the process in motion. And what we're hoping, once the agency is set up, the next step is that the subject gets legitimized. The next step is that, therefore, the scientists become interested. Then resources are made available to scientists. It's a whole kind of chain reaction that the National Science Foundation and other organizations will start putting money into investigations. The scientific investigation can become international. And what we think should happen, and I think could happen, is that the best scientific minds that we have in the world will become so interested in this subject that they will decide to become proactive, to apply themselves to working out a methodology by which they can figure out what these things are. So it's got to go way beyond just studying cases. I completely agree with you. And I just think that setting up this agency is sort of the door that needs to be open that will lead to many other things happening afterwards. But until that step is taken, we're not going to get the rest of it happening.
Okay.
I hope that makes sense to people.
Absolutely. I think it does. International line, Mary in Ontario, Canada. Hi, Mary.
Hi. I'll be as fast as I can. I think this is all black ops. In 1974 or 75 in the summer, my friend and I watched a one-hour program all in Russian with English subtitles from the inside of a spacecraft, and they were landing on Mars. And the only interesting part about the whole hour was that at the end, when they were landing and looking around the sand, they noticed that there was movement in the sand, and they were pointing to it, and they were going, oh, look, like there is life on Mars because something has to be burrowing under the sand. And like I said, it was all in Russian and all English subtitles. I only saw it once with my friend. It's never come back, and this was not 74, 75.
You lost me on how this would prove that all of this is black ops.
Well, they have so many bases. They have so much money going into these black ops. They've been working with flying saucers since the 30s. What are they doing with all this money? And why would they show a program in Russian and then, you know, pull it off the air and never see it again? Just like I watched one on plastics, never saw it again. And I think, yeah, it's all black ops. That's why you have all these debunkers. That's why I think it's a matter of the right hand not knowing what the left hand is doing.
Well, I don't think there's any way, first of all, because something was shown on television, that we have any way of knowing whether it's legitimate or not. I mean, you can't make that assumption. I think the chances that the Russians have landed on Mars are pretty minuscule, and we still don't know about it today. So, I mean, you know, there are all kinds of things that go on television. And, George, I mean, haven't you worked hard on getting documents from Russia? You may even know more about the whole Russian thing than I do. I mean, I don't know much about it.
Well, I'm pretty darn sure the Russians haven't landed on any Martian surface. They've sent probes to some of the Russian moons, but this must have been an entertainment program, and I'm not quite sure why Mary assumes that this entertainment program that aired once is a black op. But
exactly. I don't really get the connection either. But
I don't either.
There's a lot of people that think like that, and so I don't know.
But you know what? I buy the idea, Mary, that there are a lot of sightings of UFOs that probably are classified programs. Certainly is the case here in Nevada, where we've got places like Area 51. People see strange things in the sky. They assume they're UFOs. And they are, I guess, in the strictest sense. They're just not UFOs in the generic sense of being mysterious things from somewhere else. Thanks for the call. Wildcard line, Ray in Cocoa Beach, Florida. Hi, Ray. Better make it a quick call.
Hey, George. Hey, Leslie. Yeah. Hey, I was thinking about what you said earlier about only government officials can get near reports and get the full data. And I was kind of wondering why you weren't motivated to become a government official for that very reason, or what actually would take to get to that level.
Well, I mean, personally, I've been trained as a journalist, you know, and that's sort of what my career is. I mean, I'm in no position to become a government official. You can't just sort of decide to do that. I think I'm honored that you would think I could even be one, but it's just not the path that I'm on. My interest is really digging out the information and providing it to people, and then hopefully that can become a tool to affect the government officials. And I like working with the government officials, but it's not ever any something. I'm not really interested in becoming one myself. That's about the best answer I can give. But we need those officials, and I hope that I'm going to be able to work with them to create change.
You'd have to get pretty lucky to be get into the government, to get into these particular programs and get into the secret vault, if assuming there is something like that. But
and once you do, you're not going to be talking about it anyway. So,
thanks for the call, Ray. Leslie, a couple of minutes here for you to wrap it up. Where do you go now? I know the reaction so far to the book has been pretty good. Are you hearing from any government people who've read it so far and who are impressed?
No, I mean, you know, I have the team that I work with, and, you know, Governor Feist-Symington, of course, who's represented in the book, everybody is right now just sort of getting the word out, you know, hoping that people will read this book, UFOs, generals, pilots, government officials. We need those people to read the book and spread the word. I think it's a little too early, though. We've only had the book out for 4 days, and, the next step is really going to be, first of all, to get it as widely distributed as possible, because it's a tool for change, George. That's really my motivation for writing it. And once we do that, we're going to reach a certain point, and then we're going to be actively working in Washington, having the meetings that we need to have quietly but productively, and we're going to be bringing the book to those meetings and giving it to the right people. And hopefully then the next phase will be to really focus on trying to get this office set up in the way we describe in the book. So I'm hoping that everybody in the meantime will help get the word out, will help get the book out there. Go to UFOsOnTheRecord.com, and it would be really helpful if you could click on the tweet and the share buttons, which are in the upper right-hand corner of the homepage. You'll see them when you go on. That helps tremendously for us to spread the word. I mean, social networking, I guess was what they call it, is the way we need to do this. So if everybody can help by just getting the word out there, you know, buying the book, it's not expensive on Amazon. They have a great discount on the site. And click on tweet and share, and we're on our way.
And I didn't get into this, but I suppose we didn't have time, but you're not a believer in the revelation that anybody's going to kick open the doors and reveal the UFO secrets anytime soon.
No, I mean, I just don't take the position that the government is poised to make some big announcement that's going to, you know, they're going to come out and say, okay, well, we've known, that, first of all, that they're extraterrestrial, and second of all, we've known it for since 1947. I mean, I just don't think that's in the cards. You know, people have been talking about that for a long time. It hasn't happened. I don't think it's going to happen. I think this is a much more productive strategy. If we can just get the government to do this small thing, opening a huge door, even beyond their own awareness. They're not going to really understand the implications. This is what I think, anyway, of where opening the small door could lead. And that's, we just need to see that happen.
Best of luck to you, Leslie. The book is called UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record. It's an excellent read, and I hope you'll all check it out. Coming up, Robert Hastings to talk about UFOs and nukes here on Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us. Robert Hastings wrote an extraordinary book called UFOs and Nukes. We had him on several months ago to talk about some of these very disturbing incidences that he has documented so well at American nuclear facilities. We're glad to have him back. Robert?
Hey, George. Thank you for having me back. I appreciate it.
Why don't we jump right into it? I don't know if you got to hear much of Leslie Kane's discussion and interview talking about this call for creating some sort of a UFO agency for more disclosure, more study, more investigation. Did you get to listen to any of that?
I did not, unfortunately.
Well, it's sort of as a parallel development. You're looking for some kind of official recognition and disclosure and openness yourself, aren't you?
For the last nearly 40 years, I've been attempting to bring to public attention the fact that over 100 former and retired military personnel have gone on the record as saying nuclear weapons have been compromised by UFOs. apparently there have been countless incidents since the 1940s of saucer-shaped craft hovering over, maneuvering near either missile sites, nuclear bomb storage facilities, nuclear weapons laboratories, nuclear test sites in the South Pacific and Nevada, on and on. And the persons who were involved in these incidents are trying to get this message out, as I am, that this is real, it's ongoing. And consequently, we are holding a press conference in Washington, D.C. at the National Press Club on September 27th. And former nuclear missile launch officer Robert Salas, Bob Salas as he's known, and I are co-hosting this event. And at some point here, I'd like to describe the event itself and who would be involved in that.
Let's do it right now.
Well, what we've attempted to do is provide people who were involved in UFO-related incidents at nuclear weapons sites at a number of different bases. One of them is going to be on the second hour, Bruce Fenstermacher. He is a retired U.S. Air Force captain. In 1976, he was a nuclear missile launch officer. The technical name for that is Missile Combat Crew Commander. He was at F.E. Warren Air Force Base near Cheyenne, Wyoming, when one night down in the launch capsule, which is 60 feet underground, he got a call from one of his guards topside saying that there was strange reports of an object near the facility. I'll let him describe that in great detail. Long story short, they had a cigar-shaped object hovering at one point directly over the launch control capsule. It later moved off and moved from missile site to missile site. Each one of those launch control capsules controls 10 missiles. His guards were reluctant to follow the object, as he will report to you. Another individual who will be attending the press conference, participating, I should say, is Jerry Nelson. He is a former Air Force First Lieutenant. He was, again, a nuclear missile launch officer, except involved with the Atlas missile systems at Walker Air Force Base in New Mexico in 1964. He is going to tell the assembled members of the press that on half a dozen occasions in the fall of 64, he, too, got calls from his guards topside saying there was a UFO hovering directly over the launch site. A third person who will be attending or participating, I should say, is Patrick McDonough, who in 1966 was a geodetic survey team leader. His job was to do surveys of nuclear missile sites being put into place outside of Malmstrom Air Force Base in Montana. While he was working doing one of these surveys at night, suddenly he and his two-man team were startled to see a saucer-shaped object come racing in from the north. It stopped and hovered what he estimated to be 300 feet above this launch silo, and they were terrified. They fled the scene, rolling their truck in the process. There were no repercussions whatsoever. They were debriefed, but no one said, "How come you rolled the truck?" The commanders obviously wanted the incident to go away. McDonough says that when he went to a nearby farmhouse to report the accident, the state policeman that showed up said there were over 20 calls in the immediate vicinity by local ranchers and other civilians reporting a UFO. Another person who will be participating in the press conference is a retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Dwayne Arneson, who in 1967 was the officer in charge at Malmstrom Air Force Base's Communication Center. Colonel Arneson will tell the assembled press that he did receive a call some date in 1967, he read a message about a UFO hovering over a missile site just as a large number of missiles malfunction. We are of the opinion that he is referring either to the Echo flight incident or the Oscar flight incident. There is evidence of two entire flights, that is 10 nuclear missiles at each of those locations, malfunctioning in March of 1967. Bob Salas, who I mentioned previously, who is co-hosting this event with me, was involved in one of those incidents at Oscar flight. We believe we pinned down the date to March 24th, 1967. He, too, was down in the launch capsule when he got a call topside from his guard saying there was a saucer-shaped object hovering over the facility. Before he had a chance to respond, his missiles began dropping offline. He believes all 10 missiles failed. His commander that evening, now retired Colonel Fred Mywald, thinks that 6 to 8 missiles went down. In any case, Colonel Maywald has confirmed that a security alert team, that is police, armed guards, were sent out to one of the missile sites to investigate this and saw an object hovering near the missile site and came racing back to the launch control facility, just scared out of their wits. So we have those persons. Also, last but not least, we have, Bob Jamison is a former Air Force captain who, again, was at Malmstrom Air Force Base in 1967, who was involved in the restart of the missiles that malfunctioned at Oscar Flight. He has been on Larry King with Mr. Salas and myself and says that while he was waiting at the missile maintenance hangar to go out in the field to restart the missiles at Oscar Flight, he and the other targeting teams were explicitly told that UFOs were involved in the shutdowns, and they, in fact, were held back going into the field until all reports from the field of UFO activity ceased.
Tell me this, Robert. You have all these guys. They have really good stories to tell. They're credible people. You have this event at the National Press Club, and maybe some press shows up, and maybe they don't. But what's the best-case scenario? What makes this worthwhile for you? Do you have to have a certain number of stories, or are you looking for more to come out of it?
Well, I think I can speak for Mr. Salas and certainly for myself. We believe that an effort needs to be made to have a press conference in which a number of these key witnesses can present their stories to the media. For six decades now, the mass media have ignored UFO witnesses, have, if they reported UFO stories at all, citing reports, they've not been treated in a serious manner more often than not. The point that I am making to the assembled media, anyone who is willing to attend this, is that here you have witnesses of the highest caliber, persons that the U.S. government entrusted with the operation or working with weapons of mass destruction. They were thoroughly vetted to do what they did, and they and these other 120 or so people that I've interviewed, these persons that were trusted by the governments to operate weapons of mass destruction, are now saying that UFOs have repeatedly visited those weapons and on some occasions shut them down. So again, I think the effort needs to be made. Whether this falls on deaf ears or not is out of my hands. But certainly the affidavits these gentlemen have signed are going to be available. They'll be circulated on the internet. Slowly but surely, I've used this analogy many times. It's like water dripping on a stone. After enough time, the stone wears away. The resistance on the part of the media and UFO skeptics in general is there. It's a fact of life. But more and more of these high-caliber witnesses are coming forward and talking about their experiences.
And I think you could make the distinction of the kind of cases that you're talking about versus the run-of-the-mill, somebody sees something in the air and they can't identify it. This is just about as serious as it gets. I mean, I can't imagine any UFO cases more serious than the ones you're talking about.
Oh, precisely. And, you know, for your audience members who are too young to remember the Cold War era, you know, for several decades, the Soviet Union and the United States basically held the world hostage by threatening to use nuclear weapons against each other in huge numbers. You know, it was the standoff between capitalism and communism, and we had our spheres of influence, and so did they. The problem was we were armed to the teeth with enough weapons to destroy human civilization many times over. Those weapons in smaller numbers still exist. I have a whole chapter in my book, UFOs and Nukes, devoted to near misses, accidents, best known as the Cuban Missile Crisis, but there were at least 20 other occasions where either we or the Soviets misread the other guy's signal and were about to launch nuclear weapons. My contention is as long as those weapons exist, even though in smaller numbers, human fallacy, you know, failings being what they are, the potential exists for those weapons to be unleashed. And not only will the two people at war, the two countries at war, be affected, but because of wind currents, radioactivity would drift around the entire planet. The planetary ecosystem would be compromised. Before I forget to mention, the last person who will be participating in the press conference is well known, probably to many of your listeners, retired U.S. Air Force Colonel Charles Holt, who was the deputy base commander at RAF Bentwaters in England in 1980. Colonel Hall is on the record as saying that he witnessed a saucer-shaped object hovering near the Bentwaters weapons storage area, sending down beams of light into it, and hearing on the radio chatter from personnel stationed at the weapons storage area that, in fact, those beams had fallen not only near but into this sensitive nuclear weapons storage site. So, again, you know, these are persons whose stories should be listened to by the media. You know, all we can do is present their cases and hope that the response is appropriate and serious on the part of those attending the press conference.
Well, let's say Joe, reporter from the Washington Post or whatever, comes to the press conference. He hears these stories. He calls up the Pentagon for a comment. What are they going to say?
Oh, well, what they've been saying since 1969 is that the Air Force stopped investigating UFOs in 1969 with the closure of Project Blue Book. That's the official story, and they claim to have had no interest in UFO activity since then. But if you get beyond that public relations smokescreen that everybody from the Washington Post to the New York Times to, you know, the major news networks have swallowed hook, line, and sinker for decades, and actually go and interview the witnesses like the six people, the seven people who will be attending the press conference, you'll find an entirely different story. Over the years, the Freedom of Information Act has been used with mixed success in the United States to access documents which confirm that Blue Book was basically a public relations front designed to pacify public opinion, to make the American public think that the Air Force was seriously investigating UFOs. Whereas in reality, we now know, and some of these press conference participants will confirm, the people who are actually involved in the serious UFO investigations, specifically those affecting national security, including the nuclear weapons cases, were conducted by intelligence and counterintelligence groups. Most often mentioned is OSI, the Office of Special Investigations. Now, the Pentagon, you know, when they announced the closure of Project Blue Book, you know, and there was no word, no mention whatsoever of other groups in the Air Force involved investigating UFOs. But we now know, as a result of FOIA requests, that indeed the real serious investigation,
the Bollinger memo.
Yeah, the Bollinger memo. Yes, General Bollinger admitted that national security-related UFO incidents were never a part of the Blue Book system, quote-unquote. Other FOIA releases have confirmed the CIA has been up to its ears in UFO investigations and data collection, as has the National Security Agency. So, you know, there was this sleight of hand in the late 60s, and the media bought it, again, hook, line, and sinker. Most of the American public are unaware that, in reality, beyond the Blue Book era, the Air Force has continued to utilize these other intelligence and counterintelligence groups to investigate UFOs.
Well, again, back to the mythical reporter who covers your news conference and then calls the Pentagon for a comment. Can the Pentagon say you guys are full of baloney?
Well,
can they suddenly say that that there's no credibility to any of those guys who are standing up telling these stories?
If I were in their shoes and trying to maintain the game plan that's been in place for six decades now, what else can they say? That's precisely what they will say. We, speaking for myself, I have no illusions about this event changing government policy on this. I think the questions need to be raised. The witnesses' testimony needs to be out there. You know, getting back to the Watergate crisis, the political crisis that ultimately led in to the resignation of President Nixon, most of the media ignored what two reporters from the Washington Post diligently uncovered, Woodward and Bernstein. And, you know, they were more or less pariahs in the journalistic community month after month after month. The other newspapers and TV stations and so on just more or less accepted the fact that there was no high-level involvement in it. Well, these two guys persisted and ultimately led to the downfall of the presidency. My view is that if one intrepid reporter is out there willing to take on this very monumental task of investigating the truth and speaking the truth and reporting the facts, then we have a shot at getting, you know, this the log jam, the stone wall, to collapse. That would be my fondest hope.
Well, I would think you'd get some people to show up. But I guess it depends on what else is going on in Washington, what other story breaks that day. But I would think it'd be just too sexy to resist for reporters to come over there and hear what you guys have to say. At the same time, though, I think that of all the UFO secrets that the government has held, that the lack of control or loss of control of nuclear weapons would be the last one that they would want to get out.
Well, obviously, this is a very sensitive subject. And when other types of UFO reports might be begrudgingly acknowledged, the Pentagon and whoever else is involved in the secrecy is simply not going to volunteer that our nuclear weapons have been compromised. But the fact remains it has gone on. The witnesses who are there, who have credentials, who are credible sources, are coming forward one by one. You know, if I had the money and the wherewithal, you know, 100 or so people I've interviewed over the years would go on the record and be assembled, but that's obviously not feasible. So these 6 or 7 people are going to be representative of what's taken place. Now, as you well know, George, and perhaps could address here momentarily, this is not confined to the United States. With the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, a number of Western journalists, including yourself, traveled to the former Soviet Union and interviewed former and retired Soviet military personnel, some of whom had stories to tell about nuclear weapons-related incidents in that country. Just very recently, in mid-June of this year, a major Russian newspaper, Life, published an updated article about one of those incidents in Soviet Ukraine in October of 82, which you were involved in investigating and uncovering to some degree. In any case, new witnesses have been interviewed, new documents have come to light. And
well, we can talk about that. We need to take a break here, but you and I can talk about that, as well as the larger question of whether there has been a danger of actually triggering a nuclear war because UFOs might be misinterpreted as incoming missiles. We'll get into that and more with our guest, Robert Hastings, author of UFOs and Nukes. Stay with us here on Coast to Coast AM. Robert Hastings, what is going on? Why is this, why the UFO interest in our ICBMs? And I ask it in this context. I just told the story during the break about the Soviet Ukraine ICBM incident back in the early 1980s. Colonel Boris Sokolov, that I looked up and interviewed for the first time, told me he was the chief investigator of that incident. He said that he and his team interpreted it as the UFOs sort of sending a message that these might be the Russians' most powerful weapons, but the UFO occupants, whoever they are, were not impressed. Why the interest? Are they trying to send us a message, do you think, or is it they're just checking out our best and most formidable technology?
I agree with that assessment entirely, as does Bob Salas. In fact, I think the majority of the people who are going to be participating in the press conference would agree with that assessment based on the conversations I've had with them. In fact, I recently calculated that some 3/4 of the persons I've interviewed, over 120 at this point, former and retired military personnel in the U.S., when I've asked them their opinion of what all this adds up to, they are of the opinion that the technology involved is so beyond human capability at this point that these are likely beings from somewhere else. Who they are, where they're from, how they get here, who knows? But there does seem to be a distinct pattern of interest in and occasional interference with our nuclear weapons, both here in the Soviet Union. One viable scenario, in my opinion, is that they are, whoever they are attempting to warn us that we are playing with fire, that use of nuclear weapons on a large or small scale would be, catastrophic for the human race. Not only our civilization would be in jeopardy, but as I pointed out earlier, because of global wind currents and so forth, a large-scale nuclear attack by two major powers, U.S. and Russia, for example, could pollute the entire planet for a long, long time with radioactivity.
Is there a case in the U.S. comparable to the Ukraine case? I know there are instances that you describe in your book where they're hovering over these things and disable them, but is there any case where there are credible reports that the UFOs are able to enter launch codes or alter launch trajectories or something like that as part of the incident?
There is indeed. In fact, probably the most dramatic report in my 600-page book is one by David H. Schur, who was a nuclear missile launch officer at Minot Air Force Base, North Dakota, in 1966. And Schur reports that one night while he was down in his underground nuclear missile launch capsule, he got a call from his guard topside saying that a bright object was moving from missile to missile to missile. Again, each launch control capsule, he was at Echo at Minot, controls 10 missiles. As he listened in fascination and then horror, this guard was reporting an object hovering above a given missile. At that moment, down in the launch capsule, his control panels lit up and indicated that that missile was preparing to launch. David Schur says that he and his commander had to activate what's called an inhibit switch shortly after they did that to prevent the launch of that particular missile. The UFO moved at a high rate of speed, instant stop. It went on to another missile, at which point the launch panel indicated that missile was now being activated and preparing to launch, virtually identical to what was reported in Soviet Ukraine. And long story short, after a few minutes, the object moved away from their flight. What they could hear on this radio system called PASS, the primary alert system down in each launch capsule, that this UFO had moved among all of the missile flights, each one controlling 10 missiles at Malmstrom Air Force Base over the course of, he thinks, more than an hour. The next day, when he and his launch commander returned to the base to be debriefed about all of this and to turn in their logs and so forth, their operations officer said, "Nothing happened, nothing to report, go home." And it was quite clear that probably an earlier crew had reported what had gone on. The commanders knew and did not have to discuss this with everyone involved in an effort to minimize the amount of discussion. It became a non-incident. Many of these launch officers and missile guards who were involved in these incidents say that they were not debriefed. They say, you know, they were told this never happened, this was a non-incident, and never discuss it, but there was no formal debriefing per se. On the other hand, persons like Bob Salas was indeed debriefed, as was his launch commander, Fred Maywald, and were told by an OSI agent not to discuss this. This, again, was in 1967. Mr. Salas kept his secrecy until the mid-1990s. So as I describe in my book, the way this is kept secret varies from base to base and case to case. I don't know if it's an issue of the left hand not knowing what the right hand was doing, or if in the earlier days in the 60s they were still formulating sort of a response to these kinds of incidents. But the response I find is reported to me by my witnesses. It varies from base to base. But it's quite clear that the commanders know what's going on. They know it's deadly serious, and they classify it at a very high level immediately.
Well, you can look at it a couple of different ways. I mean, I'm sure that the Pentagon gets these initial reports and they view it as hostile, something with hostile intentions there, unless it's some security test that they're implementing themselves, which we can talk about. But you can also look at it another way, is that if these entities, whatever they are, can change launch control codes or seize control of the missiles, take them down or get them ready to go, that they could do a lot worse than they've done, that they really are seemingly sending a message of some sort.
That's correct. And I think that's the logical conclusion, that if whoever they are intended ill will, had ill will toward the human race, or wished to launch a nuclear war or so on and so forth, they would have done that. I am of the opinion, and as are others I've spoken with, that these beings, whoever they are, simply testing the weapon systems, simultaneously demonstrating they have the ability to do whatever the heck they want, as your Russian source Sokolov said, but also are probably, by temporarily activating these missiles as they did in Ukraine and North Dakota, are trying to learn how the systems work, how the launch is activated, so they can learn how to inhibit it themselves. That's my view on what's going on.
Of course, the potential for misidentification of this is tremendous. I mean, we know, you know, and I have heard as well, that there have been high-level discussions about, hey, we need to have some kind of a back-channel communication so that these UFOs pop up. We don't think that you guys are shooting missiles at us.
That's correct. I've heard those things, too. I can't say that I've talked to anyone directly who was involved in those kinds of decisions or proposals for back-channel communications, but I'm aware that, those claims have been made, yes.
Is there any chance that some of these incidents at the northern tier bases, where the five bases were visited one right after another back in the mid-1970s, that this was some sort of a security test by some security agency? Hey, let's pretend to be UFOs and test the security procedures at these bases.
Skeptics favor that theory when you suddenly have ex-military sources of the caliber of the persons who are going to be at the press conference talking about UFOs shutting down their missiles. Because they don't believe UFOs exist, they come up with these scenarios. Oh, it's the Air Force secretly testing various plans and systems to keep the missile guys on their toes. Well, the missile launch officers themselves, Bob Salas will tell you this, and the others who were involved in the shutdown incidents, no test ever conceived by the Pentagon would involve the degrading of the strategic capability. You do not knock 20 missiles offline, as happened at Malmstrom Air Force Base in March of 67, just for the purposes of testing the readiness of the launch crews. If war had been declared at that moment, you're suddenly 20 missiles short or 10 missiles short in a given incident. So that theory simply does not hold water. I have a whole chapter in my book devoted to radar personnel, civilian personnel, FAA controllers who were at Malmstrom in the 60s and 70s, who said they were tracking objects flying faster than the SR-71, the fastest known aircraft. And these objects were doing zigzag maneuvers all over Montana at the same period they were being reported by the launch personnel at the missile sites. A number of attempts were made to intercept these objects by military aircraft, and they just vastly outran the jets that were sent up after them. So, you know, again, if you investigate the facts and you look at the radar data and everything that's involved, all of these alternate scenarios simply do not hold water.
Probably the most famous incident, best known around the world, incident of UFOs intruding at a place where nuclear weapons were stored is Bentwaters, Rendlesham Forest. And I know you've, Colonel Halt, who was there at the scene, is going to be one of the guys at your news conference. But you've had an interesting dialogue going of late with this British guy who basically, I think, is accusing you of rewriting history. He's looked at the original statements made by Halt and some of the other guys who were interrogated afterwards and says, you know, they didn't say any of this stuff then. You're just making it up.
Well, the gentleman you're talking about is Dr. David Clark, and he's a professor at a university in England, and he has more or less, as I can tell from what's been put on the internet, has set himself up as the official spokesman or unofficial spokesman for what the government in Britain knows about UFOs. He is a consultant to that country's National Archives. Over the last, recent past, there have been six separate releases of documents from the British government through their Freedom of Information Act or simply voluntarily by the British government. This is all low-level stuff, as I have tried to point out to Dr. Clark. It's nothing of a sensitive or dramatic national security nature. He is of the opinion that this is all the British government has secret, and they're releasing it forthrightly to the British people. And I'm pointing out to him in my online dialogue is that that's not the way it works in the United States. You know, they're pulling the same thing, in my opinion, in the UK. They're doing this shell game, this sleight of hand, where they say, we're going to be honest with you, the British people, and release everything we know about UFOs. Meanwhile, things are being kept from public view. Now, Colonel Halt talks about seeing this UFO hovering over the Bentwaters weapons storage area in December of 1980 and sending down beams of light into it. I have interviewed two witnesses, one who was a direct witness to a UFO near the weapons storage area, although he did not see the beams of light. Another witness talks about another UFO on a previous night, at least two nights that week, between Christmas and New Year's of 1980, visiting the weapons storage area. Colonel Hault has said that behind the scenes there were high-level investigations by OSI and other intelligence groups within the U.S. military. He also mentions the presence of personnel assigned to M15, a British intelligence service, who were investigating all of this activity. Dr. Clark apparently believes that because no documents have surfaced supporting Colonel Hault's statements, that those things could not have possibly occurred. So, you know, in my view, he's being naive. I think he's well-intentioned, but he's already made statements that are factually incorrect, and I will be rebutting those statements in the next few days. For example, he said that Colonel Hault did not make his claim about a UFO near the weapons storage area until, quote, decades later. Actually, Colonel Hault retired from the Air Force in 1986. By 1991, he had publicly addressed this subject and talked about the UFO near the weapons storage area on an Unsolved Mysteries program, which Dr. Clark apparently did not know about. So I think his intentions are good, but Dr. Clark simply is being naive when he thinks that the low-level documents recently released is all that the British government has.
Well, I mean, it's an easy thing to say. He just throws that out there. People who don't want to believe it was anything strange will go ahead and latch onto that and case closed.
Exactly so, and most people aren't going to investigate the details of all of this. They're not going to read the witness testimony that I published in my book from the guards who were at the weapons storage area. Dr. Clark has stated that his belief is that most UFOs are misidentified man-made or natural phenomena, which most UFO researchers agree with. However, he thinks that the unexplained cases involve anomalous aerial phenomena, some sort of atmospheric phenomena not quite understood by science at that point. Well, if you look at the thousands of documents that have been declassified in the United States, the majority of the cases involve structured craft, metallic in appearance, having a saucer shape or cigar shape, dome structures, lights around the perimeters, and so on. And they move in very controlled, intelligently controlled maneuvers and so forth. Clearly, these are not vague atmospheric phenomena. So his bias is at the outset, coupled with what he thinks he knows about how government secrecy works, have yielded, have resulted in his not representing the facts and not really even understanding the facts, which is fine. There are lots of UFO skeptics, but he seems to have set himself up again as an unofficial spokesman about what the British government knows about UFOs, and he simply is not qualified to be in that position.
I guess every country needs one. You know, you need a Phil Klass or
yep.
Am I correct in saying that at least some of the airmen who were witnesses at the Rendlesham incidents were debriefed, were maybe shot up with sodium pentothal or something like that afterward?
Well, those rumors have circulated. I try to be conservative and say that the persons that I've talked to have not addressed being debriefed in that manner. I do know that there were interrogations of some of the witnesses of the weapons storage area, according to the people that I've interviewed. On the other hand, some of them were not debriefed. And again, there seems to have been at least two incidents over the course of a week of UFOs near the weapons storage area. Some of the people say, no, we don't recall any UFO near the site. Others who apparently were there the same night say, yes, it was right there above the site. And I have at the UFODigest.com website, I've posted my entire chapter on Bentwaters, my investigation. The chapter is titled Beams of Light.
And it's a good read. We'll be back with more from Robert Hastings, and we'll be joined by his colleague, Bruce Fenstermacher, who was an Air Force captain, was in the Air Force 21 years, served at Warren Air Force Base, Cheyenne, Wyoming, during a key period, and we'll hear what he saw firsthand. Stay with us here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. I'm talking about UFOs and nukes with Robert Hastings. We're joined now by Bruce Fenstermacher. Robert, why don't you introduce Bruce and tell us how the two of you hooked up?
If I recall correctly, sometime in early 2009, I read his account on the internet. He said that he was a missile launch officer at F.E. Warren in 1975, he thought, when this incident occurred. It later turned out to be 76. In any case, what he described caught my attention. He can describe in detail what went on. What I found quite admirable on his part, he was aware that Bob Salas has been criticized by skeptics who said that nothing ever happened at Malmstrom, no missiles were shut down by UFOs, etc. And Mr. Fenstermacher felt that the time has come for a person such as himself, who witnessed incidents similar to that at other bases, to come forward and speak out about what they witnessed, and to defend the witnesses who are already on record, who are being criticized and savaged by persons who really don't know what they're talking about. So I'll let Bruce take it from here.
Captain, thanks for joining us. Tell us the story.
Okay. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
It was the fall of 96. My deputy and I were on duty at the Romeo Launch Control Facility at the 400th SMS Missile Squadron at F.E. Warren Air Force Base. And we were sitting around. Missile duty is kind of strange. You have hours, minutes of panic with hours of nothing in between. And we were in that in-between nothing. And we weren't allowed to sleep, so we tried to stay awake. And this night, we were listening to the VHF radio contact between our flight security controller, our topside NCO, and the security alert teams who were out running from site to site, checking when the rabbits would set off the alarms and that sort of thing. And our FSC said, you know, it was around 2 o'clock, and the FSC said, pull over to the SAT team and get out of the truck and look around and tell me what you see. And my deputy, who I call Sam, because I've not been able to contact him to get permission to use his name, Sam and I just kind of immediately got real alert, looked at each other, and said, what's going on? And, you know, he said, pull over, get out of the truck, and look and see what, tell me what you see. And they said first they didn't see anything, and then we heard, oh, shucks, or words to that effect. Yeah, we do see something, and the FSC said, what do you see? And the SAT team, one of the SAT team members, in an excited voice, said they saw a light in the sky, a bright white pulsating light. And the FSC, where do you see this? And they answered back, it was to the north. And then he paused and said, it looks like it's right near the launch control facility. And then the FSC said, you know, return to the launch control facility. And Sam and I looked at each other, and we kind of did a double take, and I immediately got on the hotline with the FSC and said, what the heck's going on? He said that right above him, right at that point in time, was a very silent object, had a white pulsating light. In between the pulsations, he could see a blue light and a red light. And I asked for more specifics. He said he thought it was shaped like a very fat cigar and was maybe 80 to 100 feet above him and somewhere around 40 feet long.
Now, is he seeing this visually, or is there, would he have radar or something to
No, he's him? Seeing this visually. This is right above launch control facility. And he was, you know, he said he called the SAT team to confirm it because he thought he must be seeing things. And, you know, he just couldn't believe what he was seeing.
And then the guys on the ground, they confirmed it. They saw it too.
Yes. And they said it was located, because what I found interesting was the FSC didn't ask, look over here and look up at the launch control facility. He just said, look around. Look around. What do you see? Wasn't leading them at all. And they said white pulsating object, and that's what he saw right above him at that time. And then it kind of moved away to the east down this access road that we had. And I said, you know, keep me appraised. And my deputy and I were saying, you know, what should we do? Yeah, we got to report this. We got to do something. And then the FSC called us back in a couple of minutes and said it went a few miles to the east and stopped what appeared to be right above a nearby launch facility, a missile site. So we ordered the SAT to go to that site, and they reported they had to go back to our launch control facility for batteries for their flashlights. And we called a couple times later, and they'd not left yet, but they were just getting ready to go, is what they said. And then, I almost said his real name, Sam and I decided we would report this incident to the SAC command post. And an NCO answered, and he laughed at us, and he said, when the thing ate the SAT, you know, call me back. And he hung up on us.
Meaning keep your mouth shut, or what?
No, it was like, I don't believe a thing you're saying. It's when it eats your SAT team members, then call me. And he hung up. And then the FSC called us again and said it appeared to move above another launch control facility. A launch facility down the road, another missile silo. And we ordered the SAT again to go to that location. And they called back and said they had to gas up the truck. And it seemed to take, you know, a long time for them to get started again. In the meantime, every hour we would check with the other LCFs in the 400th SMS. And, of course, Sam and I told them about what we had seen, or actually we didn't see it, we heard it. And they laughed at us and didn't believe us. And shortly after we hung up, the crew from Quebec called us. You know, when we dropped them off on the way to Romeo, our launch control facility. And they called us back and said they had a similar object at a couple of their launch facilities. And I asked, what direction were they heading? And they said it was heading towards you. So I said, what happened when you reported it? And the answer was, are you crazy? We're not going to report that. So we called the SAC, the F.E. Warren SAC command post several more times. And I finally said, you know, did you enter this incident in the log? And when they said no, I said, you know, let me talk to the officer in charge. And I told him that if they didn't report it, I would wake up the base commander right then and now. It was like 3 o'clock. And they said they would log it. And shortly after that, they called me. And then they asked for more information. So I really believe they put it in their log.
It seems like not reporting that would be a pretty serious breach. You know, it could be a pretty important security problem.
Well, we thought it would be. And my deputy and I were both prior enlisted. So we were a little less afraid of SAC than the people that were born and bred SAC. But no one wanted to be laughed at. I didn't want to be laughed at either.
What's the aftermath? Is there anybody that comes talk to you the next day or ask you about it?
Yes. Actually, when we came, we stopped by and picked the Quebec guys up the next morning. I want to mention a couple things, other things if I could.
Mm-hmm.
The FSC said it moved to another launch facility, and the SAT team never made it to there either. And then around 4 a.m., it rapidly moved away and went to a star size and then disappeared. We were relieved the next morning, and we went upstairs. The FSC was curled up in a chair. He'd been relieved, but he was unable to sleep, and he was obviously distressed. We pressed him about why did the SAT team have so much problem going to the launch facilities, and he made us promise that we wouldn't report them, but they said to him they weren't going to any launch facility that had that thing over it.
They were scared.
Yeah, and they never really left the LCF area. And we discussed this incident with the crew on the way back, the Quebec crew that we picked up and took them back. And they said they would not report it. They did not report it. And if we included them in our report, they would deny that it happened. So we briefed our flight commander, and then we were called into the commander's office a couple days later. And we're told that to be careful to not mention this to anyone. But the really interesting thing, and I think this will answer your question, at our next several departure meetings, an officer in uniform that we didn't recognize briefed the crews that this incident was classified and officially it never happened and that we should not discuss it with anyone, including our own crew members.
Well, what do you make of it? I mean, could it have been some sort of a security test of some sort? Had you ever heard about anything like this happening before or after?
No, I had not. I had not heard of anything before, but what I did hear, the SAT team members, I eventually never talked to them, but I talked to others, and they said there were rumors that years before a UFO took away one of the SAT team members, and that was the rumor that they had, so that's why those guys were so afraid.
Oh, yeah.
At the time, I thought there were like four different options. The first thought was that it could have been a hoax, but with two separate launch control facilities involved and seeing that young man that morning, I know they were, it was not a joke. It was not a hoax. It was not a big, elaborate joke. And then I thought it was either a U.S. craft of some sort doing testing to see how it would react to things, even though it was silent and very fast moving. Or perhaps it was a, you know, back then the Russians were the big enemies, that it was a Russian special aircraft that was coming over to check on our nuclear capabilities. And then the last option, and I've been a skeptic for years, and I still am, but my last option was that it was some strange device, aircraft, craft from outside of our world, or as we know it, that was checking on our nuclear capability. And here we are 34 years later, and there has been no aircraft that, even today, that approaches that sort of capability.
So have you changed your opinion?
Oh, yes. I firmly believe that we're being monitored by someone with a much higher technical knowledge than we have, and perhaps trying to warn us that perhaps, you know, we ought to be careful playing with this nuclear stuff.
Is there any risk for you in telling this story?
Well, Robert,
Robert?
was kind enough not to tell my hesitation. I first, you know, told him a generic story without having him use my name because I was really concerned. I absolutely was concerned that, you know, I would get a knock on the door and be taken away for violating classified rules or whatever, or, you know, and so far it hasn't happened.
Well, maybe there's a lesson in there, Robert, that other people who have information about these kinds of instances can come forward without fear of retribution.
Let me say that I have 600 pages in my book of accounts such as the one Bruce just related. Again, these are credible people who either operated or guarded weapons of mass destruction, and they're describing the kinds of incidents that Bruce just did. Of the 120 or so people that I've interviewed beginning in 1973, not one of them has been visited by the Air Force, the FBI, or anyone else. My opinion is that the powers that be realize that if these guys are courageous enough to go forward with their stories, if they're leaned on, so to speak, threatened, it could backfire. And, you know, these people will go to the media and say, look, I was involved in this and now I'm being threatened because I'm talking about it. Now, that's speculation on my part. Regardless, not one military person I've talked with over these three plus decades has ever been hassled or threatened. I should quickly take care of some business and say that my book is available only at my website. People have gone to Amazon and seen it sold for $125 or whatever. It's scalpers who want people to think it's out of print. It's not. It's available at a modest price at my website, ufohastings.com. I should also mention that the press conference, which we're organizing, which Bruce Fenstermacher will be participating in, is costing a significant amount of money. And Bob Salas and I have been asking for donations for nearly a year now, no matter how large or small. We are hoping to get contributions that will allow us to fund this project, to videotape it. The videotape will be put on the Internet. And, you know, again, at my website, there is a way to contribute to the financing of this press conference. Obviously, these kinds of stories are of tremendous importance. Again, as I said at the top of the last hour, for, 50 years, the U.S. and the USSR had held the world hostage with its their threatened use of nuclear weapons. And, what is now slowly but surely coming to light, all during that period, both U.S. and Soviet nuclear weapon sites were visited repeatedly by UFOs. And on some occasions, missiles were tampered with and did malfunction both here and in the former Soviet Union. This is a monumental story. It has been ignored by the media in the U.S. and all over the world decade after decade after decade. We think it's time for some courageous reporter, some courageous news organization to finally step up to the plate and investigate the facts and tell the story as it is.
Bruce, tell me this. What was your clearance like? What kind of background check did you have to go through? Because I would imagine it'd be pretty strict given the job that you had.
It was a very thorough background check, yes.
It's
very thorough.
Hard for them to say that you're a wacko or a crackpot or a liar at this point.
Well, it's easy for them to say it, but I don't think that they can justify saying it, though.
And are you said you hadn't been able to find Sam. Is that is there significance in that, or is he in a black project, or he just disappeared, or what?
No, I've not been able to contact him. He's got a short last name, and I found a few people that could be him, but they've not responded back. I would love for anyone that was involved in that, and there are like 10 different people that were involved in that. The four officers that made up the teams, the four SAT team, and then the two FSCs, I would love for them to contact Robert, because I'd like to fill in some blanks. I mean, I wish I had written everything down, and actually Sam and I did, but then we were told to destroy anything, so I don't have the names of anybody else involved. I would love for them to contact us.
Whoa, let's back up. You were told to destroy anything that you'd written down?
Yes.
Who said that?
Our squadron commander.
So this didn't happen, and if you wrote any notes, destroy them.
My gut reaction with the crew meeting was when they said, not to talk, this didn't happen, and don't talk about it. I really wanted to stand up and say, well, if it didn't happen, then there's nothing to talk about, is there?
Have you ever had an incident, any other kind of thing, not involving UFOs, where your commanding officer tells you this didn't happen and don't talk about it?
Yes, in Southeast Asia once or twice, but that's...
And you can't talk about it.
No, I can't, and I won't talk about it. But
Southeast Asia meaning Vietnam?
Yeah. Okay. Southeast Asia meaning Southeast Asia.
Okay. Okay. Well, Robert, there have been a lot of other paranormal type stuff associated with these kind of incidents at the northern tier bases. And I want to ask you if there are any of those kind of animal mutilation or other weird sightings associated with what happened at this base, Warren Air Force Base, when we come back. We need to take a break. Here on Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us. Bruce, I want to ask a question before we open up the phone lines. I'm curious about what personal effects this incident had on you. Did you start reading about UFOs? You said you were a skeptic. I'm just wondering, did you start delving into it? Did you tell your family?
I told just my close family, and they were a bit skeptical, too. I did not read up on it. I at the time, I just wasn't confident that it wasn't an advanced U.S. or Soviet aircraft.
Or even a psychological exercise or test or something?
No, I never thought that. It was just covering the Quebec and Romeo LCFs, and I didn't think it was that kind of test. I thought it would be too complicated. And seeing that young, if I hadn't seen that young man so terrified, kind of in a ball on the chair, I might have thought it was a test or something, but he was afraid. He was concerned.
That was the real deal. Now, tell me this. You're going to stand up at a news conference in Washington and tell that story. You okay with doing that? And if you are, and you say you are, so I have to believe you, what do you hope comes of it other than finding some other guys come forward?
Well, it was very refreshing a couple of years ago, I was watching Larry King Live and saw Robert Salas on there, and it was like, you know, a weight lifted off my chest that someone else had a very similar experience. So Robert has brought me along nicely because I wasn't going to use my name. Originally I told the story, but I put it on the website with no names other than a first name. And I've come to where I'm comfortable with using my name, and I've not been carried away either, you know, carried away to a sane asylum or carried away, period.
Well, you're not insane, and we thank you for coming forward with the
absolutely
information, and we thank Robert for being sneaky enough to bring you along slowly. Robert, go ahead.
Yeah,
go ahead, Bruce.
You asked me what I hope to accomplish. I hope to get one of the people that observed that thing that night or heard that thing with me to come forward and help me square away some facts and figures. It's been 34 years. I'd like to get more details.
Well, we would all like to have that, and maybe one of those guys is listening to this program and can either email me or Robert or you or call in or figure out another way to communicate with us. Robert, you know that there have been, around those northern tier sightings and UFO intrusions over nuke bases, that were extraneous sorts of phenomena, animal mutilations, things of that sort. Anything like that in association with Warren?
Actually, yes, and let me quickly say that the most recent report of a UFO near a nuclear missile site occurred sometime in 2007. I have this from an active duty security policeman who I do not want to identify or even further interview until he's left the Air Force. I don't want to ruin this gentleman's career, but apparently as recently as 2007 at Oscar Flight, the same flight that Bob Salas was at in 1967, there was a UFO right near the launch control facility, which they're now calling missile alert facilities. The Air Force has changed their name. To answer your question, in my book, I have a whole chapter devoted to cattle mutilations, specifically those that occurred in missile fields, the large area that has all the missiles underground at a given Air Force base, including F.E. Warren. In the 1977 time frame, there were multiple cattle mutilations found near missile sites in the missile field. I have in my book a report from, I believe his name was Graves, a local sheriff, who went on the record as saying that they actually thought these were, perpetrators, human perpetrators involved in these mutilations. They actually staked out these locations under cover of darkness. And what they witnessed was a large UFO they called Big Mama that would hover above the missile field and then release smaller, bright objects which would drop to the ground and then move around on the ground and then move back up and rejoin Big Mama. And the next morning, they found mutilated cattle. So there's a very strong UFO link, not only at F.E. Warren, but at Malmstrom Air Force Base and to a lesser degree at Ellsworth Air Force Base in South Dakota that I've been able to find a few facts about.
And who the heck knows what that connection is? We won't put Bruce on the spot on that particular question. We will go to the phones, though. Wildcard line, Dan. How you doing, Dan? Good morning.
Good evening, George. How are you, my friend?
Okay. How's it going?
Good. Listen, on page 192 and lower part of 192 and the upper part of 193, Dr. Stephen Greer's disclosure book, he has written down that he gave an interview with Colonel Ross Diedrichsen, and that these ETs were able to stop a nuclear weapon from being exploded over the South Pacific, and on the moon. That NASA was going to do some nuclear weapon testing on the moon, and the ETs intercepted, because that's not acceptable to them, and I agree. And I was just wondering if your guests know anything about it. It's in the disclosure book by Dr. Stephen Greer. Had the conversation with Colonel Ross Diedrichsen on page 192 and 193. UFOs intercepted nuclear weapons from being done over the South Pacific and on the moon.
Okay.
I can read it to you, but I'm just stating it right now.
We got you. Robert, does this ring a bell?
I'm aware of those claims. I can't say that I can independently verify that information. I'm just going to leave it at that.
Stephen Greer has made a lot of different kinds of claims. He remains a controversial person, but do you find that the basic story something that sounds reasonable? or you don't really know?
I wouldn't go that far. Unless I've interviewed a source and have their DD-214, their service records, and try to find some corroborating sources, I'm going to withhold judgment about those particular stories.
Hey, Dan, thanks for the call. Sorry we couldn't help you there. Also on the wild card line, Carl in Wisconsin. Hi, Carl.
Good morning, gentlemen. You know, as I sit here as a night owl, I feel so righteously blessed to be able to participate in such lively and intelligent conversation. You know, the technology that's involved to travel from star system to star system is so far beyond anything in our own paradigms, in our imagination, in our own world. And I'm always amused that the descriptions are, you know, the saucers, the Pluto platters, the cigar shapes, almost something from, you know, a Jules Verne novel. Are we too quick to eliminate, you know, our own government, you know, from testing the systems that we have in place?
I would like to respond to that. UFO sighting reports in after World War II at nuclear weapons sites go back at least to December of 1948, according to declassified FBI memoranda. They're describing saucer-shaped objects, cigar-shaped objects, flying at enormous velocities at a time when the fastest aircraft we or the Soviets had could travel 600, 700 miles per hour. My question would be, if we had, we or the Russians had saucer-shaped craft that could travel 10 times that fast in the 1940s, why have we spent 60 years spending trillions of dollars and rubles building fixed-wing aircraft that are vastly inferior to these saucer-shaped craft that have been reported decades ago? Now, what I find interesting, I went to school in 1968 to college, majoring in astronomy. And long story short, I've been interested in astronomy, cosmology, theoretical physics ever since, even though I did not become a professional astronomer. Until the last 20 years or so, the Einstein light limit dictum held sway in theoretical physics. What that is, long story short, is that Albert Einstein said nothing having mass, whether it's an apple or a spaceship, can achieve the speed of light because the distances between star systems are so vast. Skeptics have said even if aliens are out there, they could not travel from their worlds to ours with the kind of frequency that UFOs have been reported. However, in recent years, theoretical physics has done radical changes and now is proposing, among other things, something called hyperspace, higher dimensional space, which is being examined and studied, and over 100 papers have been published about how hyperspace can be used to achieve faster than light travel. In other words, if another civilization in the Milky Way galaxy figured out all of this 100 years or 1,000 years or a million years ago, they may be able to travel many times the speed of light and traverse not only our galaxy but elsewhere in the universe. If one Googles hyperspace or higher dimensional space, one will find that there are over 100 published papers in scientific peer journals talking about how advanced aliens could indeed travel between planets in various star systems.
Carl, your point is well taken, though. I mean, I think everybody who has spent any time in researching UFOs would acknowledge that there are probably a pretty big percentage of cases that really do represent sighting incidents and reports that really do represent sightings of advanced military aircraft, secret aircraft, things of that sort. But I'm not sure that that theory would explain all of them, certainly not ones that occurred many, many years ago before we even had these capabilities. But thanks for the call. East of the Rockies, Jeanette. Good morning, Jeanette.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi. We hear you.
Hi, I wanted to just ask a question. Why do they think that the aliens allowed us to bomb Hiroshima?
That's an excellent question, and I simply cannot answer that. I do know, based on an eyewitness account from a man named Bud Clem, who was a Navy pilot during World War II, his squadron was stationed at the Hanford site in Washington State, which created the plutonium not only for the Trinity blast, the test in New Mexico, but for the bomb that was dropped on Nagasaki, the second Japanese bomb. He reports that on at least three occasions in
January and February of 1945, months before the Japanese bombings, members of his squadron, his naval fighter squadron, chased away a UFO on three separate occasions that was hovering directly above the Hanford plutonium site. So there is a UFO nuclear weapons link even prior to the Japanese bombing. There is another corroborating witness who is talking about the very same incident at the Hanford site. All one can say is that they obviously, whoever they are, did not, for whatever reason, intervene and stop the Japanese bombings. But it's quite clear, based on that account that I just mentioned and the documents that have been declassified from the FBI, the Air Force, and the CIA, that UFO activity at Los Alamos, the birthplace of nuclear weapons, and Sandia Labs in Albuquerque, at Oak Ridge, and in Hanford started in earnest and continued on an ongoing basis beginning in late 1948.
And Jeanette, the best we can do is just guess about it. I mean, maybe they didn't see it coming. Maybe they're restricted by the Star Trek Prime Directive that they can't directly intervene. They can mess with Bruce and his guys at Warren Air Force Base in some way, but they can't go so far as to actually stop the action. I mean, we're really speculating here. We have no idea, but it's an interesting question. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say it's an absolutely valid question, and we don't know. All we can do is look at the available facts and, see what they might imply.
A first-time caller, Kyle in Ohio. Hi, Kyle.
How are you doing tonight?
Okay.
First of all, I just want to say what an honor it is to talk to you three gentlemen. And my question was, is it a worldwide phenomenon that these nuclear facilities are a hotbed for UFO activity? I'll take my answer off here.
Thanks. Robert, thanks. Well, we know about the U.S. and with the USSR, what about other countries?
I'm aware of reports in France. The French had a nuclear weapons program. It's largely dismantled at this point. I'm aware of reports in the South Pacific, in French Polynesia, where hydrogen bombs were being tested in the 1970s, if I'm not mistaken. Maybe it was the 60s. Off the top of my head, I don't recall the time frame. In any case, UFO activity had been reported by some of the French nuclear technicians who were present during the tests. I'm aware more recently of sighting reports in both India and Pakistan, which have been saber-rattling over the last decade and threatening to use their nukes against each other. I'm aware of reports in those two countries near nuclear facilities. I have found it difficult enough just to track down and interview firsthand witnesses, eyewitnesses to what's gone on in the U.S. George Knapp have had a window into some of the Soviet incidents. But it's just extremely difficult from my vantage point and with my limited resources to take this investigation worldwide and track down witnesses who might have something to say about what's going on elsewhere.
You know, we do hear in news reports, current news reports, about the Iranian nuclear program, and they have UFOs supposedly hovering over their facilities. I suspect they have a lot of UFOs hovering over their nuclear facilities, and a lot of those are craft that are built by us taking a look at them, or the Israelis.
Quite possibly, yes.
Hey, Bruce, tell me this. Is your family okay with you coming forward and talking about this to the press corps in Washington?
Well, my parents have long gone, and my wife is okay with it. My brothers and sisters don't know what I'm doing right now. So.
Have you evaluated the possible consequences?
Well, they're my family. They got to live with it.
And with you. We'll try to get one more call in. Steve in Virginia on the wild card line. Hi, Steve.
Good evening. Just a scenario. If we have all these nuclear weapons and these whatever can come in and shut them down, would you want to be a government to tell your people that the best thing we got, we can't control, they can?
Yeah, that's
and
a good point.
Another thing is, if I had back engineered these things, I wouldn't have them out on the White House lawn because I wouldn't want those who are coming down with them to know I got them.
Excellent point, Steve. Robert?
I would just simply say yes. That's absolutely right. The Pentagon, the Kremlin are not going to voluntarily admit that all of this is going on. even though the tensions between our two countries have receded relative to the Cold War period, you do not admit to some other country that your strategic weapons, your first-line nuclear weapons, are compromised on an ongoing basis by persons or beings unknown who have a technology vastly superior to what you have. You're just going to not announce that voluntarily. The best that can be done, in my view, is to have people like Bruce and Bob Salas and the other people who've come forward to come forward in even greater numbers. You know, right now I've interviewed 120-some people over 37 years. There are thousands and thousands of people out there who are at these missile sites or these weapons storage areas who are aware of what we're talking about tonight but who have not come forward. Those people need to make their voices heard. So the American people and the rest of the world need know and understand that this is real, this is ongoing, this is not science fiction, this is very dramatic stuff. And the fact that it's been kept secret for so many years boggles my mind. But if you talk to the witnesses like Bruce and Bob Salas and the others who will be at the press conference in September, you'll see that the people that our government trusted to operate or guard nuclear weapons are now talking about UFOs shutting down those weapons from time to time.
Okay. Bruce, we got about a minute left. Any parting thoughts for our audience?
No, I want to thank you for having me on, though.
Well, we appreciate it, and I hope Sam or some of your other colleagues will come forward. Robert, any chance that you write a follow-up to UFOs and Nukes?
I'm working on a second edition. It could be a couple of years before that is out. You know, beyond that, I don't have any immediate plans. I'm just hoping to publicize the testimony of these people in the near term. Who knows who's going to show up at the press conference, but we've got the Internet to spread this message far and wide after the fact.
Well, I think the turnout might be better than you think. Robert Hastings, thanks very much. Bruce Fenstermacher, appreciate your first appearance on Coast to Coast. Also, thanks to Leslie Kane. Thank you all for joining us as well. We'll see you next week.